Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, Dark Apprentice, Volume 2 of the Jedi Academy Trilogy by Kevin J. Anderson. The huge orange sphere of the gas planet Yavin heaved itself over the horizon of its fourth moon. Soft, misty light shone across the ever-stirring jungles and the ancient stone temples. Luke Skywalker used a Jedi refreshing technique to remove weariness from his body. He had slept soundly, but the future of the New Republic and the fate of the galaxy weighed heavily upon him. Luke stood atop the squared pyramid of the great temple that had been abandoned millennia before by the lost Masasi race. During their early struggles against the Empire, the Alliance had built a secret base in the ruins, from which they had launched their desperate attack against the first Death Star. Now, 11 years after the Rebels' departure, Luke had returned to the fourth moon of Yavin. Now he was a Jedi Master. He would be the first of a new generation, like those who had protected the Republic for 1,000 generations. The old Jedi Knights had been respected and powerful until Darth Vader and the Emperor had slaughtered virtually all of them. Luke had received support from Mon Mothma, the New Republic's chief of state, to seek others who had a potential to use the Force, trainees who might become part of a new order of Jedi. Luke had managed to bring 12 students to his academy on Yavin 4, but he felt uncertain about the best way to train them. His own instruction by Obi-Wan and Yoda had been abbreviated, and Luke had since discovered facets of Jedi lore that made him realize just how much he still did not know. Even a great Jedi like Obi-Wan Kenobi had failed with his student and had let Anakin Skywalker become a monster named Darth Vader. Now Luke was expected to instruct others and make no mistakes.
Do or do not, Yoda had said. There is no try.
Luke closed his eyes and let his hands hang at his side, his fingers spread. He let his mind open and relax. He drew strength from the Force, touching ripples made by the life forms crowding the jungles below. With heightened senses, he could hear the rustle of millions of leaves, twigs scraping, small animals scurrying through the underbrush. The plants grew, the animals flourished. The moon awakened to a new day. Yavin 4 was alive, and Luke Skywalker felt energized. Listening intently, he heard 2 people approaching far off in the dense foliage. They moved quietly, but he could sense the change in the jungle as 2 of his Jedi candidates made a path through the undergrowth. He had sent them off into the wilderness to sense and study other life forms touching the Force. Luke decided to go down to meet his pupils. As he turned to re-enter the echoing stone halls of the temple, Luke looked up at the sky to see the streaking trails of a shuttlecraft descending through the humid atmosphere. He realized with a start that the Academy was due for another delivery of supplies. Luke had been so focused on training new Jedi that he had lost touch with galactic politics. And what was happening with Han, Leia, and their children, he hoped the pilot would bring news. He shrugged down the hood of his brown Jedi cloak. The garment was too warm for the jungle humidity, but Luke had stopped noticing minor physical discomfort. When the Rebels had first set up their hidden base in the Masasi Temple, they had scoured the thick plant life from the chambers. Across the river stood another prominent temple, and according to orbital surveys, more structures lay buried under the implacable vegetation. But the Alliance had been far too wrapped up in its war against the Empire to bother with detailed archaeological inspections. The vanished race of temple builders remained as much a mystery now as when the Rebels had first set foot on Yavin 4. The temple's flagstone corridors were uneven but remarkably unscathed after centuries of exposure to the elements. Luke took a turbo lift from the pinnacle down past the 3rd level, where other students slept or meditated in the early morning. Luke's Jedi Academy was by no means luxurious. In fact, it was barely even comfortable. He had not repaired all the damage caused by time, but he had refurbished the glow panels, water systems, and food prep facilities the Alliance had installed. When Luke reached the ground level of the temple, the partially raised hangar bay doors stood like the dark slit of a mouth. Luke walked past the hangar bay and outside into the jungle. His timing was perfect. As he walked through the lush foliage, he heard his 2 Jedi trainees approach. Tall, dark Gantoris parted heavy branches and came forward to meet Luke. His high forehead had been shaven clean of eyebrows. His skin looked chapped and weathered. On the hellish world of Il-Sha, Gantoris had used an innate talent with the Force to keep a small group of forgotten colonists alive. Gantoris had had nightmares of a terrible dark man who would tempt him with power and then destroy him. At first he had thought Luke was that man. Behind Gantoris came Streen, the second candidate Luke had found in his Jedi search. As the trainees bowed, Luke clasped their hands. "Welcome back. Tell me what you've learned."
"We found another Mishashi temple," Streen said breathlessly.
"Yes," Gantoris said. "The new temple isn't as large as this one, but it seems more potent somehow. It's made of obsidian, sitting out in the middle of a shallow, glassy lake with a tall statue of a great lord."
"A site of great power," Streen said.
"I felt the power, too." Gantoris tossed his thick braid behind him. "We should learn all we can about the Mishashi race. They seem to have been very powerful, but they vanished entirely. What happened to them? Is there something we need to fear?" Luke nodded gravely. He, too, had sensed the power in the temples. He knew the dark power that Gantoris had detected, and although he told his students they must share what they learned, Luke felt that certain knowledge could be deadly. Darth Vader had discovered the wrong kind of knowledge. Luke clapped his hands on their shoulders. "Come inside, take a drink. A supply shuttle is landing, so let's go greet our guest." When they reached the cleared landing pad, R2-D2 waited next to the grid control kiosk, chittering coordinates to a descending X-23 Starworker space barge that had seen better days. The hull of the space barge muttered to itself as it settled. With a coughing hiss, the rear cargo doors slid apart slowly. Bluish-white light shone down on crates and boxes wrapped in storage nets or bolted to a wall, food, communications equipment, clothing, and amenities. A narrow ramp extended with a groan of pistons and rollers from the raised pilot compartment. A silhouette of a man appeared on the ramp. He descended, yanking his white helmet off. Luke grinned. "Wedge! Doesn't the New Republic have anything better for its generals to do? A delivery driver in space?" Luke embraced Wedge Antilles in the greeting of two friends who had not seen each other in far too long. "You've got to admit I'm qualified for the job," Wedge said. "I've been tidying up after the Imperials, doing demolition work in the armpit of Imperial City and cleaning up wrecked spacecraft in orbit around Coruscant. I figured a delivery driver is better than a garbage man." Gantoris came forward from the cargo bay and gave Wedge a quick, almost brutal handshake as he locked eyes with the pilot. "General Antilles, have you any word from my people? I trust they have all been safely shuttled to their new home on Dantooine." "Yes, Gantoris. They're all settled in, doing fine. We drop-lifted an entire settlement of self-erecting living modules. We sent them programming units and agricultural droids so they could establish a viable colony right away. Dantooine is a very mild planet. Plenty of animals to hunt and native vegetation to eat. Trust me, they'll be much more comfortable than they were on Il-Sha." Gantoris nodded solemnly. "That I do not doubt." "Gantoris, Streen, please start unloading the supplies. I don't think you'll have trouble lifting the crates with a little nudge from the Force. Consider it a test." Luke clapped his friend on the shoulder. "I'm starving for news, Wedge. How are Leia and Han? How's Mon Mothma? How are things on Coruscant? And when is Han going to bring Kip Duron to my training center?" Wedge shook his head at the volley of questions. "Kip will be here, Luke. Don't worry. He spent most of his life in the spice mines of Kessel, and he's only been out a month. Han's trying to show the kid how to live a little first." Luke remembered the dark-haired teen Han had rescued from the black spice mines. When Luke had used a Jedi testing technique to see if Kip had potential to use the Force, the boy's response had knocked Luke across the room. In his entire Jedi search, Luke had never encountered such power. "And what about Leia?"
She seems to be spending more and more time with her duties as Minister of State. Mon Mothma has been handing off a lot of important responsibilities to Leia, while she herself stays in her private chambers and rules from a distance. It's got a lot of people disturbed."
That behavior seemed highly unusual for the strong, compassionate ruler Luke remembered. "And how's Leia handling it?"
"Leia's doing a wonderful job, but she's trying to do too much, if you ask me."
Luke nodded.
"And what about you, Wedge? You going to be a delivery driver the rest of your career?"
Wedge smiled, and then with a flick of his wrist, he tossed his helmet up the ramp and into the open cockpit. It clacked and thumped across the floor.
"No. In fact, I came here because I have a new assignment. I won't get a chance to see you again for some time. The New Republic Council feels that Dr. Kwee-Zooks may be in danger from espionage. Admiral Dalla is still out there somewhere with her fleet of Imperial Star Destroyers. And any time now, I expect her to start blasting planets at random with hit-and-run strikes. She may try to get Kui back. Luke nodded gravely. Kui Zoox had been the top scientist in the Imperial Research Facility that Admiral Dalla's ships had guarded. If Admiral Dalla doesn't want Dr. Zoox back, I'm sure someone else will. Yala, that's why I've been assigned as her personal bodyguard and escort. In the meantime, the Council still hasn't decided what to do with the Sun Crusher weapon that Han captured from Dalla. That's just scratching the surface of everything going on back on Coruscant. Fidgeting from the long voyage in the expanded B-wing fighter, Leia Organa Solo rode in silence beside Admiral Akbar as the ship plunged through hyperspace. Being Minister of State kept Leia on the move, shuttling from diplomatic event to ambassadorial reception to political emergency. Dutifully, she hopped across the galaxy, putting out fires and helping Mon Mothma hold together a fragile alliance in the vacuum left by the fall of the Empire. In her younger days, Leia had devoted her life to the rebellion. Now, though, she felt torn between her duties as Minister of State and her duties as Han Solo's wife and as mother to three children. She had allowed the New Republic to come first, this time, again. Beside her in the cockpit, Admiral Akbar moved his amphibious hands fluidly as he manipulated several control levers. "Dropping out of hyperspace now," he said. The salmon-colored alien swiveled his gigantic glassy eyes from side to side as if to take in every detail of his craft. He seemed an integral part of the gangly craft that appeared to be all wings and turbolaser turrets mounted around a dual cockpit. Akbar's crew of fish-like calamarians, led by his chief starship mechanic, Terpfin, had expanded the former one-man craft into Akbar's personal diplomatic shuttle, adding a single passenger seat. Through the curved dome of the cockpit windows, Leia watched as multicolored knots of hyperspace evaporated into a star-strewn panorama. The sublight engines kicked in and the B-wing streaked toward the planet Vortex. "Beautiful," Leia said, peering out the viewport to the planet beneath them. The blue and metallic gray ball hung alone in space, moonless. Its atmosphere showed complex embroideries of cloud banks and storm systems, racing spirals of clouds that swirled in horrendous gales. Leia remembered her astronomical briefings about Vortex. The sharp tilt of the planet's axis produced severe seasonal changes. At the onset of winter, a vast polar cap formed rapidly from gases that froze out of the atmosphere. The sudden drop in pressure caused immense air currents, like a great flood going down a drain. Clouds and vapor streamed southward in a battering ram to fill the empty zone where the atmosphere had solidified. The Vors, hollow-boned humanoids with a rack of lacy wings on their backs, went to ground during storm season, taking shelter in half-buried hummock dwellings. To celebrate the winds, though, the Vors had established a cultural festival renowned throughout the galaxy. Deciding to review the details one more time before they landed and the diplomatic reception began, Leia touched the icons etched into the synthetic marble frame of her datapad. A translucent image shimmered and grew out of the silvery screen in a miniaturized projection of the Cathedral of Winds. Defying the hurricane gales that thrashed through their atmosphere, the Vors had built a tall, ethereal structure that had resisted the fierce storm winds for centuries. Delicate and intricate, the Cathedral of Winds rose like a castle made of eggshell-thin crystal. Thousands of passageways wound through hollow chambers and turrets and spires. Sunlight glittered on the structure, reflecting the rippling fields of wind-blown grasses that sprawled across the surrounding plains. At the beginning of storm season, gusts of wind blew through thousands of different-sized openings in the hollow walls, whipping up a reverberating, mournful music through pipes of various diameters. The wind music was never the same twice, and the Vors allowed their cathedral to play only once each year. During the concert, thousands of Vors flew into or climbed through the spires and windpipes, opening and closing air passages to mold the music into a sculpture, a work of art created by the weather systems of the storm planet and the Vor people. Decades before, objecting to the excesses of the Empire, the Vors had sealed the holes in their cathedral and refused to let the music play for anyone. But this season, they had invited representatives from the New Republic to come and listen. A Vor voice crackled over the comm channel.
"New Republic craft, we are transmitting landing coordinates that take into account wind shear and storm systems along your descent. Our atmospheric turbulence is quite unpredictable and dangerous. Please follow precisely."
"Understood." Staring ahead, Akbar took his B-wing into the swirling atmosphere of Vortex, straight toward the storm systems.
Akbar knew that humans could not read expressions on Calamarian faces. He hoped Leia did not realize how uneasy he felt flying through such hellish weather patterns. Leia did not know that Akbar had volunteered to take the mission because he trusted no other person to pilot someone as important as the Minister of State. The craft began to rattle and jitter. His stomach lurched as a sudden updraft let them plunge until he managed to wrestle control back. Blurry fists of high-rising clouds pummeled the transparasteel viewports.
New Republic craft, we show you off course. Please advise.
Akbar turned his left eye to double-check the coordinate display and saw that the starfighter had indeed veered off course. Calm and focused, he tried to force the craft back onto the appropriate vector. He couldn't believe he had gone so far astray unless he had misread the coordinates in the first place. As he yanked the B-wing toward a wall of spiraling clouds, a blast of gale-force winds hammered them into a roll and slammed Akbar against his pilot seat. He hauled with all his strength upon the levers, firing stabilizer jets in a counterclockwise maneuver to counteract the spin. The B-wing responded, finally slowing its crazed descent. Akbar looked up to see himself surrounded by a whirlwind of mist. He had no idea which direction was up or down. Suddenly the clouds peeled away like a wet rag ripped from his eyes. The wind-whipped plains of vortex spread out below, furred with golden brown and purple grasses. Concentric circles of bunker-like vor shelters surrounded the center of their civilization. He heard Leia gasp in a deep wonder that sliced through even her terror. The enormous cathedral of winds glinted with light as clouds marched overhead. The high, lacy structure seemed far too delicate to withstand the storms. Winged creatures swarmed up and down the sides of the fluted chambers. In the distance, he could hear the lilting, eerie notes.
New Republic craft, you are on the wrong course. This is an emergency. You must abort your landing.
With a shock, Akbar saw that the displayed coordinates had changed again. The B-wing did not respond as he fought the controls. Leia stared out the viewport. We're heading straight for the cathedral. One of the aileron struts buckled and snapped from the plasteel hull, dragging power cables as it tore free. Sparks flew and more hull plates ripped up. Akbar strangled an outcry. Suddenly, the control lights flickered and his main cockpit panels went dead. He hit the second auxiliary backup.
I don't understand it, Akbar said. This ship was just reconditioned. My own Calamarian mechanics were the only ones who touched it.
On the crystalline cathedral of winds, multicolored vores scrambled down the sides, fleeing as they saw the craft hurtling toward them. Akbar hauled the controls to the right, to the left. All the power had died. Desperately, he hit the full battery reserves, knowing they could do nothing for the mechanical subsystems, but at least he could lock in a full-power crash shield around the B-wing.
I'm sorry, Leia. Tell them that I'm sorry.
He punched a button on the control panel that cracked open the right side of the cockpit, splitting the hull and blasting free the tacked-on passenger seat. Leia found herself flying through the air. The ejection seat's safety repulsor lifts slowly lowered her toward the pale-hued grasses below. She looked up to see Akbar's B-wing in the last instant before it crashed. The starfighter smoked and whined as it plunged like a metal filing toward a powerful magnet. In a frozen moment, she heard the loud, mournful fluting of winds whistling through thousands of crystalline chambers. The breeze picked up with a gust, making the music sound like a sudden gasp of terror. The winged vores scrambled and attempted to flee, but most could not move quickly enough. Akbar's B-wing plowed into the lower levels of the Cathedral of Winds like a meteor. The booming impact detonated the crystalline towers into a hail of razor-edged spears. The sound of tinkling glass, the roar of sharp broken pieces, the shriek of the wind, the screams of the slashed vores, all combined into the most agonizing sound Leia had ever heard. The polar regions of Coruscant reminded Han Solo of the ice planet Hoth, with one crucial difference. Han was here by choice with his young friend Kip Duron for a vacation, while Leia went off with Admiral Akbar on yet another diplomatic mission. He'd left 3PO and Chewbacca in charge of the twins, Jason and Jaina. Han stood atop the crumpled blue-white ice cliffs. The ever-present auroras in the purplish skies sent rainbow curtains refracting off the ice. He drew in a deep breath of crackling cold air that seemed to curl his nostril hairs. He turned to Kip beside him. About ready to go, kid? For the fifth time, the dark-haired 18-year-old bent over to adjust the fastenings on his turbo skis. Almost. Han leaned forward to peer down the steep turbo ski run of rippled ice, feeling a lump form in his throat, but unwilling to show his anxiety. Blue and white glaciers shone in dim light from the months-long twilight. Below, ice-boring machines had chewed deep tunnels into the thick ice caps. Other excavators had chopped broad terraces on the cliffs,
as they mined centuries-old snowpack, melting it with fusion furnaces to be delivered via titanic water pipelines to the dense metropolitan areas in the temperate zones. "You really think I can do this?" Kip said, straightening and gripping his deflector poles. Han laughed. "Kid, if you can pilot us single-handed through a black hole cluster, I think you can handle a turbo ski slope on the most civilized planet in the galaxy." Kip looked at Han with a smile in his dark eyes. Ever since Han had rescued Kip from the spice mines of Kessel, the young man had clung to him. After years of wrongful Imperial imprisonment, Kip had missed the best years of his life. Han vowed to make up for that. Han held onto the deflector poles and flicked them on. He felt the cushioning repulsor field emanating from each point, making the poles bob in the air to keep his balance. "You're on," Kip fired up his own skis, "but not the kiddie slope." He turned from the wide ice pathway and pointed instead to a side run that branched off over several treacherous ledges, across the scabby ice of a rotten glacier, and finally over a frozen waterfall to a receiving and rescue area. Winking red laser beacons clearly marked the dangerous path.
"No way, Kip! It's much too..."
But Kip launched himself forward and blasted down the slope. Han had no choice but to blast after the boy. Kip kept his balance like an expert, intuitively knowing what to do. After only a second of the thundering descent, Han realized that Kip might be more likely to survive this ride than he was. Ahead, the icy roadway seemed foreshortened and continued at a different elevation far ahead. Han realized the danger an instant before he reached the precipice.
"Cliff!"
Han yelled. Kip bent low as if he had simply become another component of his turbo skis. He tucked his deflector poles close to his sides, then fired up the rear jets of his skis. He rocketed over the edge of the cliff, arcing down in a long, smooth curve to the resumption of the trail. Barely in time, Han activated his own jets and launched himself over empty space. His stomach dropped even faster than gravity could tug him down. Wind ruffled the edges of his parka hood. In front of him, Kip landed smoothly without so much as a wobble and shot down slope. Han had time to take only one gulping breath as the plateau of ice rushed up to meet his turbo skis with a loud crack. He gripped his deflector poles, desperate to maintain his balance. A powdery ribbon of drifted snow curled across their path. Kip hopped up into the air and cleanly missed the drift, but Han plowed straight through. Snow flew into his goggles, blinding him. He jabbed from side to side with his poles. He managed to swipe a gloved hand across his goggles just in time to swerve left and avoid smashing into a monolithic ice outcropping. Ahead, Kip encountered a blocky, rubble-strewn glacier field. He wobbled as he struck hummocks of ice and snow. Behind him, Han muttered complaints and curses. He kept his balance somehow, but Kip had lost ground. Han found himself breathing the boy's wake, pushing closer and faster, and suddenly the race meant something to him again. Afterward, while sitting around in a cantina and swapping stories, he would somehow convince himself that the whole thing had been a great deal of fun. He found his way to the steep ice waterfall, the final obstacle before the finish line. The edge of the precipice flowed with tendrils of icicles that had built up over centuries during the brief spring thaws. Kip launched himself over the edge of the frozen river, igniting both ski jets. Han did the same, tucking his poles against his ribs, watching the packed snow fly up to strike the bottom of his skis with a loud slap that echoed in unison with the sound of Kip's landing. They both charged forward, then slowed to a stop in front of the cluster of prefab huts. Kip peeled down the hood of his parka and started laughing. Han held onto his deflector poles, feeling his body tremble with relief and an overdose of excitement. Then he, too, began chuckling. "That was really stupid, kid."
"Oh?" Kip shrugged. "Who was stupid enough to follow me? Hey, maybe we should ask 3PO to tell us the odds of successfully negotiating that slope when we get back."
Han shook his head and gave a lopsided grin. "I'm not interested in odds. We did it. That's what counts." Kip stared across the frozen distance into something only he seemed to see.
"I'm glad we've had so much fun, Han. I've done a lifetime's worth of healing since you rescued me."
Han felt uncomfortable at the thick emotion he heard in Kip's voice. He tried to lighten the mood.
"Well, kid, you had as much to do with our escape as I did."
Kip didn't seem to hear.
"I've been thinking about what Luke Skywalker said when he found my ability to use the Force. I only know a little bit about it, but it seems to be calling me. I could do a huge service to the New Republic. The Empire ruined my life and destroyed my family. I wouldn't mind getting a chance to strike back."
Han swallowed, knowing what the boy was trying to say.
"So, you think you're ready to go stay with Luke and the other Jedi trainees?"
Kip nodded.
"I'd rather stay here and have fun for the rest of my life, but..."
"You deserve it, you know,"
Han said. But Kip shook his head.
"I think it's time I start taking myself seriously. If I do have this gift for using the Force, I can't let it go to waste. Han gripped the young man's shoulder and squeezed hard. I'll see you get a good flight to Yavin 4. Han looked up as a messenger droid approached, streaking like a chromium projectile over the ice fields. The droid arrowed straight for them. It snapped open a scanning panel and spoke.
General Solo, please confirm identification. Voice match will be sufficient.
Oh, I'm on vacation. I don't want to bother with any diplomatic mess right now.
Voice match confirmed, thank you. Prepare to receive encoded message.
The droid hovered as it projected a holographic image onto the clean snow.
Han? Mon Mothma said.
He noticed immediately that she had called him by his first name instead of his more formal rank. A fist of dread clenched his stomach.
I'm sending you this message because there has been an accident. Admiral Akbar's shuttle crashed on the planet Vortex. Leia and Admiral Akbar are safe and unharmed. But the entire structure was destroyed. So far, at least 358 Vors are confirmed dead in the wreckage. This is a tragic day for us, Han. Come home to Imperial City. I think Leia might need you as soon as she returns.
Down in the repair bays of the revamped Imperial Palace on Coruscant, Lando Calrissian couldn't imagine how Chewbacca managed to cram his enormous furry body inside the Falcon's narrow maintenance crawlway. Standing in the corridor, Lando saw the Wookiee as a tangle of brown fur wedged between the emergency power generator, the acceleration compensator, and the anti-concussion field generator. Chewbacca dropped a hydro spanner, which landed in a completely inaccessible spot. In looking for it, the Wookiee banged his shaggy head on a coolant pipe.
No, no, Chewbacca! Lando tried to point toward the circuitry. That goes here, and this goes there!
Chewbacca grumbled back, disagreeing. Look, Chewie, I know this ship like the back of my hand, too. I owned her for quite a few years, you know. All right, have it your way. I can work the access hatches on the outside hull. I'll retrieve your hydro spanner. Lando turned and made his way to the entry ramp, stomping down into the cacophony of shouted requests and engine noises in the starship mechanic bay. Admiral Akbar's carefully picked crew of Calamarian starship mechanics were overseeing special modifications to small vessels in the New Republic fleet. Terpfen, Akbar's chief mechanic, wandered from ship to ship, status board in hand, verifying requested repairs and scrutinizing the work with his glassy fish eyes. Lando pried open the access hatch on the Falcon's outer hull. The hydro spanner clattered out and fell into his outstretched hands.
Got it, Chewbacca,
he shouted. The Wookiee's answer was muffled inside the cramped access hatch. Lando looked at the scorch marks along the Falcon's battered hull. The ship seemed to be one massive collection of patches and repairs. He ran a calloused hand along the hull, caressing the metal.
Hey! What are you doing to my ship?
Lando jerked his hand away from the Falcon and looked around guiltily to see Han Solo approaching. Chewbacca bellowed a greeting from the maintenance crawlway. Han looked unaccountably angry.
I need my ship right now. She ready to fly?
Lando put his hands at his side.
I was just making some repairs and modifications, old buddy. What's the problem?
Han turned to the Wookiee.
Chewie, we've got to fly right away. Why did you let this clown mess around with my engines?
Wait a minute, Han. This used to be my ship, you know.
Lando had no idea what had provoked such anger in his friend. Besides, who rescued this ship from Kessel? Who saved your tail from the Imperial fleet? At that moment, C-3PO marched stiffly into the mechanic bay.
Ah, greetings, General Calrissian.
Lando ignored the droid and continued scolding Han.
I lost the Lady Luck rescuing your ship. I think that deserves a little gratitude, don't you?
Han looked ready to explode.
My problem is you've been sabotaging my ship. I don't ever want you touching her again. Do you understand? Get your own ship. Seems to me that with the million credit rewards you got at the blob races on Umgul, you could buy just about any ship you want. Stop messing around with mine.
An excellent idea, sir,
3PO added helpfully.
Be quiet, 3PO, Lando said. I don't want to buy another ship, old buddy. If I can't have the Lady Luck, I want the Falcon. Your wife is the Minister of State, Han. You can have the government provide you with any sort of transport you want.
Why not get yourself a new fighter right from the Calamarian shipyards?
I don't want any old ship. The Falcon is mine.
Lando glowered at Han.
You won it from me in a sabacc game. And to tell you the truth, old buddy, I've always suspected you cheated in that game.
Han grew livid.
You're accusing me of cheating? I have been called a scoundrel before, but never a cheat.
And you're a pirate,
Lando said, bunching his fists at his side. As Han and Lando closed to within striking distance, 3PO wriggled in between them.
Excuse me, sirs, but might I make a suggestion?
Could you perhaps simply play another game of Sabacc to settle this issue once and for all?
3PO turned his glowing optical sensors first at Lando and then at Han.
Han said, I just came down here to get my ship, but now you've made it into a point of honor. All right, Han, let's do it before you lose your nerve.
You're going to lose more than nerve before this game is over.
As Lando set up the cards in the Sabacc table, Han ushered the last of the off-duty bureaucrats toward the door of the small lounge.
Out! Come on! We need to use this space for a while.
They grumbled and objected in a variety of languages, but Han assisted them through the entryway with gentle shoves, saying,
File a complaint with the New Republic.
Then he closed and sealed the door, turning to Lando.
You ready yet?
At the Sabacc table, Lando spread out a handful of rectangular cards with crystalline screens sandwiched between metal layers.
Ready when you are, buddy.
But he looked uneasy.
Han, we don't really have to do this.
Han sniffed the air, frowning at the cloying smells of deodorizing mists and ambassadorial perfumes.
Yes, I do. Leia's been in an accident on one of her diplomatic missions, and I want to be the one to escort her back home, not some hospital ship. Leia's hurt?
Lando stood up in surprise.
So that's what's been bothering you. Forget it. Take the ship. I was just kidding anyway. We'll do this some other time.
No. We'll do it now, or you'll never be off my case. 3PO meticulously dealt 5 of the flat metallic cards each to Lando and to Han.
As you know, this is random Sabacc, a combination of variant forms of the game. There are 5 different sets of rules, shifted by chance and changed at random time intervals as determined by the computer's random generator. That's me.
We know the rules, Han growled, but he wasn't so certain. We also know the stakes.
Lando's deep, flinty eyes met his across the table.
Winner takes the Falcon. Loser takes Coruscant public transit from now on.
Very well, sirs. Activate your cards. The first player to reach a score of 100 points will be declared the winner.
3 hands and 3 rule changes later, Han and Lando stared in suspense as the images on the cards that made up their hands swirled and changed again, flickering from one value to another in a blur until they stabilized one by one. Finally, Lando found himself looking at low-denomination numeric cards, nothing at all spectacular, while Han got the best deal he had seen throughout the entire game, all face cards, Demise, Endurance, the Star, and the Queen of Air and Darkness, along with a balance card. His score handily passed the goal, leaving Lando in the dust. He cheered at the same instant 3PO declared another change of rules. Han glared at the golden droid, waiting.
This hand will be scored under the Eclesis Fig variation.
Han and Lando looked at each other, mouthing the words.
What is the Fig variation? Han asked.
In the final round, the scores of all odd-numbered face cards are subtracted instead of added to the final score. This means, Master Solo, that while you gain 10 points for Endurance and the Queen of Air and Darkness, you forfeit a total of 41 for Balance, the Star, and Demise. I'm afraid you lose, sir.
Han blinked in shock at his half-empty glass of spiced ale. Lando shifted uncomfortably.
I'll take good care of her, Han, not a scratch.
Without another word, Han went to the door of the lounge, unsealed it, and walked out into the echoing halls. With black-gloved hands clasped behind her back, Admiral Dalla stood at attention on the bridge of the Imperial Star Destroyer, Gorgon. In front of the bridge viewport, brilliant gases illuminated by a knot of blue giant stars turned the Cauldron Nebula into a spectacular light show. Beside her, in parking formation, hung the Basilisk and the Manticore. The ionized gases played havoc with ship's sensors, making the nebula a perfect hiding place for her 3 fully armed battleships. Dalla heard a tentative bootstep behind her and turned to face Commander Kratos.
Yes, Commander?
As she moved, her mane of coppery hair trailed behind her like the tail of a comet. Kratos snapped off a perfect salute and remained standing one step below her observation platform.
Admiral, as of 0900 hours, we have completed our assessment of the losses suffered during our battle at Kessel. Together we have lost a total of 3 TIE squadrons, and of course, all hands and resources on board that Hydra.
The Hydra, Dalla's 4th Star Destroyer, had been torn apart in one of the Maw Cluster's black holes. It had been Dalla's first significant loss in combat, 1/4 of her destructive capability wiped out by Han Solo and the traitorous scientist Kwee-Zoots, who had stolen the Sun Crusher superweapon and fled the Empire's closely guarded Maw installation.
However, 40 TIE fighters from the Hydra did manage to reach safety inside the other Star Destroyers, which makes up somewhat for the other losses.
Dala's Star Destroyers had emerged from the Maw Cluster expecting to engulf and obliterate Han Solo, but her ships had run headlong into Kessel's ragtag fleet. Though her Star Destroyers had destroyed nearly two-thirds of Kessel's ships, the Basilisk had suffered severe damage and had to be linked with the Gorgon's navicomputers for escape to a secret location in the Cauldron Nebula. "What is the status of repairs to the Basilisk?" she asked. Kratos clicked his heels smartly as if pleased to give good news and went down the lengthy list of repairs that had been made, finishing with, "In short, Admiral, I believe our entire fleet is ready for battle again." Dala tried unsuccessfully to stop a smile from creeping across her lips. "If I might ask a question, Admiral..." Kratos glanced around to see the other personnel at their stations, every head turned studiously away from the conversation. "With the information we gained from interrogating Han Solo, we know that the Emperor is no longer alive, that Darth Vader and Grand Moff Tarkin are also dead."
Dala spoke for him. "You are wondering, Commander, who our Commander-in-Chief is?"
Kratos nodded vigorously.
"Grand Admiral Thrawn has been killed, as has Warlord Zinge. We know of several commanders still fighting over the remnants of the Empire, but they seem more interested in destroying each other than in battling the rebellion. If I may make a suggestion, the Imperial Military Academy on Corrida still appears to be stable and loyal, with a great many weapons at their disposal. Perhaps it would be best to..."
"I don't think so."
Dala had been trained and trounced in the harsh military academy on Corrida. Because she was female, she had been passed over for promotion after promotion. She had been given the worst assignments, and that had only increased her drive to succeed. Finally, she had created a false identity for herself through Corrida's vast computer networks and used that identity in combat simulation rooms. She had won repeatedly, creating breakthrough tactics that had been adopted by many of the Imperial Army's ground assault forces. After Moff Tarkin had discovered Dala's true identity and realized her talent, he had secretly whisked her away, using his new authority as Grand Moff of the Outer Rim Territories. He had promoted her to the rank of Admiral, as far as she knew, the only female Admiral in the entire Imperial fleet. He had given her command of 4 Star Destroyers assigned to guard the super-secret think tank inside the Black Hole Cluster. Now that she had come out with her battleships ready to devastate any planet loyal to the rebellion, Dala could not conceive of handing over that authority to her former persecutors on Corrida. She took a deep breath again and faced Commander Kratos. "Since the factions seem to have forgotten that our true enemy is the rebellion, we will set an example for them. We must focus their attention on the appropriate enemy, the rebels. I think our best chance is to rely on hit-and-run tactics, guerrilla warfare. We have 3 Star Destroyers. That's enough to wipe out civilizations on any number of worlds. We must hit fast and run fast. We will continue to pound the rebels for as long as we can." She glanced around the bridge to see that all personnel stood staring at her, some with wide eyes and gaping mouths, others grinning. Her crew had been bottled up in the Maw, ready to fight but denied any chance at action because they were forced to guard the group of prima donna weapons scientists. Dala glanced out at the Cauldron Nebula, saw the bright lights of other star systems piercing the haze of ionized gas. Many targets waited out there. She turned to the navigator's station. "Lieutenant, I want you to plot a course for the last known shipping lanes closest to our position."
"Yes, Admiral."
The lieutenant practically leapt toward his station. "Inform all personnel on the 3 ships," Dala said. A bold grin lit her face. She felt as if her blood had become molten copper. The fight was about to begin.
"Let's go hunting,"
Dala said, and a spontaneous cheer erupted from the bridge crew. It wasn't long before Dala was able to make her first move. Her ships intercepted a Corellian transport, and Dala interrogated the captain. As she had suspected, he was delivering supplies and equipment for the rebellion to a small colony. Dantooine became the Gorgon's next destination. Luke Skywalker, Jedi Master, gathered his 12 students in the grand audience chamber of the Masasi Temple. He watched the students file toward him along the broad promenade. Streen and Gantoris moved first, side by side. Of all those Luke had gathered at his Jedi training center, Gantoris had so far shown the most progress, the most inner strength. Yet the man from Eel Shah did not seem to realize that he stood at a crossroads. Gantoris would soon need to decide exactly how he would proceed in his growth with the Force. Behind Gantoris and Streen came Kirana Tee, one of the young and powerful witches of Dathomir. She had been instrumental in helping him recover an ancient wrecked space station, the Chunthor, in which resided many records of old Jedi training, records that Luke had studied to develop exercises for his Jedi trainees. Beside Kirana T came Dorsk 81, a bald, green and yellow-skinned humanoid from a world where all family units were genetically identical, cloned, and raised to carry on the status quo. Though Dorsk 81, the 81st reincarnation of the same genetic attributes, seemed identical to his ancestors in every way, his mind worked differently. His thoughts moved along different paths, and he could feel the Force working through him. Then came Kam Solusar, an older man, son of a Jedi that Vader had slaughtered long ago. As the rest of the candidates gathered at the raised platform, Luke shrugged back his hood and tried to mask his pride at seeing the group. If he successfully completed their training, they would form the core of a new order of Jedi Knights, champions of the Force, to help protect the New Republic against dark times. Standing at the podium, Luke found the core of peace inside him that allowed him to speak with a firm voice. I have brought you here to study and to learn, but I myself am still learning. Every living thing must continue to learn until it dies. Those who cease to learn die that much sooner. Perhaps it was misleading when I called this an academy for Jedi. Though I will teach you everything I know, I don't want you merely to listen to me lecture. Your training will be a landscape of self-discovery. I will call this place Apraxium. This word, made up of ancient roots, was first used by the Jedi scholar Karena, distilling the concept of learning combined with action. Our Apraxium, then, is a place for the learning of action. Luke repositioned a small, translucent cube on the dais behind him. He ran his fingers over the cool surface of the ancient knowledge repository Leia had stolen from the resurrected Emperor. The Jedi Holocron. We will invoke a past Jedi Master from the Holocron. Let us see what stories it has for us this morning. He activated the precious artifact. In the distant past, it had been traditional for each Jedi Master to compile his life's knowledge and store it within a great repository such as this, which was then passed to one of his students. An image formed both inside and outside the cube, a half-tangible projection that was more than just a stored bit of data. It was an interactive representation of the Jedi Master, a stubby alien, part insectile, part crustacean. It seemed to be bent with age or too much gravity. Its head extended into a long funnel like a beak from which dangled whiskery protuberances. Close-set glassy eyes stared like glittering pinpoints of knowledge. The creature leaned on a long wooden staff, its legs spindly and knobby, as it swiveled its funnel-like face to contemplate the new audience.
I am Master Vodosiospas.
Master Vodo, Luke said, I am Master Skywalker, and these are my apprentices. You have seen many things and recorded many thoughts. We'd be honored if you could tell us something we should know. The image of Master Vodo Siosk Bas hung his beak-like head on a jointed elbow of neck as if thinking. Luke knew that the Holocron was simply uploading and sifting through reams of data, choosing an appropriate story through a personality algorithm stored with the Jedi Master's image.
I must tell you of the great Sith War that occurred.
Here the image paused as the Holocron assessed the current situation.
4,000 years before your time, this war was caused by a student of mine, Exar Kun, who found forbidden teachings of the ancient Sith here on Yavin 4. He imitated the ways of the long-fallen Sith and used them to form his own philosophy of the Jedi Code, a distortion of all we know to be true and right. With this knowledge, Exar Kun established a vast and powerful brotherhood and claimed the title of the first Dark Lord of the Sith.
Luke stiffened. Others have claimed that title even to this time, including Darth Vader.
Exar Kun worked his invisible threads into the fabric of the Old Republic, bringing downfall through treachery and his distorted abilities with the Force.
Master Vodo looked at the gathered students. Gantoris seemed incredibly eager to hear more, leaning forward and staring with wide, dark eyes. The image of the long-dead Jedi Master turned to face Luke.
You must warn your students to beware of the temptations of conquest. That is all I can tell you for now.
The images returned to swirling pearlescence inside its cubicle walls.
I think that's enough for now, Luke said.
We all know that other Jedi have followed the wrong path, bringing not only themselves but millions of innocent lives to doom and suffering. But I trust you. A Jedi must trust himself, and a Jedi master must trust his apprentices. Explore yourselves and your surroundings, in teams or alone, whichever makes you comfortable. Go to the jungle, go to other parts of this temple, or simply go back to your chambers. The choice is yours. Luke sat down on the edge of the dais and watched the students file out of the grand hall. The translucent cube of the holocron stood mute beside him, a vessel filled with valuable but dangerous knowledge. Obi-Wan Kenobi had been Luke's teacher. Luke had listened to every word the old man had said, trusting it. Yet Luke had later learned how often Obi-Wan had obscured the facts, had distorted information, or, as Obi-Wan explained it, simply offered the truth from a certain point of view. Luke watched the robed forms and wondered if his students could handle the knowledge they might discover. What if, like ancient Exar Kun in Master Vodo's story, they were tempted to uncover the forbidden teachings of the Sith that so subtly yet crucially differed from the Jedi Code? Luke feared what might happen should one of his students travel down the wrong path. But he also knew that he had to trust them, or they could never become Jedi Knights. Deep into the night, Gantoris hunched over the cluttered work table in his private chamber. A blanket of shadows surrounded him, obliterating distractions that might keep him from his task. Using his ability to manipulate simple objects, Gantoris had broken past the seals into the locked rebel control rooms in the temple's lower levels. Banks of machinery, computers, landing grid panels, and automated defense systems sat covered with grime from a decade of abandonment. Quietly, Gantoris had removed access panels, stripped out microcomponents, focusing lenses, laser diodes, and a cylindrical casing 27 centimeters long. It had taken him 3 nights tearing apart the equipment, stirring up dust and spores, sending rodents and arachnids scurrying to safety, but Gantoris had found what he needed. Now he assembled the pieces. Next, he took out 3 Coruscant jewels, cast out from the high-pressure hell of the gas giant Yavin's core. When he and his addle-brained companion Streen had discovered the new Misasi temple far out in the jungle, Gantoris had found these gems on the steep obsidian walls. Embedded among the hypnotic pictographs etched into the black volcanic glass, the jewels had glinted in the hazy orange daylight. Though they had remained untouched for thousands of years, these 3 gems had flaked off as Gantoris stared at them and fell to his feet. Now Gantoris removed the jewels, one watery pink, another deep red, and the 3rd starkly transparent with an inner electric blue fire along the edges of the facets. Finally, his fingers raw and aching, Gantoris sat up. Pain embroidered fire lines across his neck, shoulders, and back, but he washed it away with a simple Jedi exercise. Outside the great temple, he could hear the changing symphony of jungle sounds as nocturnal creatures found their dens and daylight animals began to stir. Gantoris inspected his work under the glow lamp's unforgiving light. He had just completed a Jedi rite of passage, the one that Master Skywalker seemed not to want to teach him, though Gantoris had waited and waited. Gantoris knew he was the best of the students, and he had chosen not to wait any longer. Craftsmanship was everything in a weapon like this. A barely noticeable variance could cause a disastrous blunder, but Gantoris had done everything right. He had taken no shortcuts, allowed no sloppiness. His lightsaber was perfect. The private investigatory proceedings of the New Republic's ruling council stood closed against Admiral Akbar. He waited in the anteroom outside, staring at the door as if it were a wall blocking the end of his life. He looked up at the sound of shuffling footsteps and saw another Calamarian approaching tentatively down the rose-hued corridors.
"Kerpfin," Akbar said, "have you completed your investigation?"
Akbar knew the unshakable loyalty of his chief starship mechanic. As with many of his people, Terpfin had been taken away from his watery homeworld, kidnapped by Imperials and forced to work on their star destroyers. But Terpfin had attempted sabotage and had been tortured severely. The scars still showed on his battered head.
"Have you gone over the records that survived the crash?" Akbar asked the mechanic.
Terpfin turned his head away. He clasped his broad flipper hands together, his skin flushed with splotches of bright maroon, showing his embarrassment and shame.
"I have already filed my report with the New Republic Council."
He looked meaningfully at the closed door of the chamber.
"I suspect they are discussing it even now."
Akbar felt as if he had just attempted to swim under an ice floe.
And what did you find?
Terpthen turned his head away. I found no indication of mechanical failure, Admiral. I've gone over the crash tapes again and again, and I have simulated the flight path through the recorded wind patterns on Vortex. I continue to come up with the same answer. Nothing was wrong with your ship. He looked up at the Admiral, then turned away again. Akbar spoke for him.
Pilot's error. I caused the crash. It's my fault. I've known it all along.
Turpin stood with his head hung low.
I wish there was some way I could prove otherwise, Admiral.
Akbar stepped forward to the closed steel stone door and pounded on the ornate surface, demanding to be let in. The heavy door groaned open on automatic hinges. Akbar stood at the threshold as the members of the ruling council turned to look at him. Gripping the edge of the table, Mon Mothma stood and acknowledged Akbar's presence.
Admiral, these proceedings are closed. We will summon you after we've taken a vote. Perhaps I can make these deliberations easier on all of us, Akbar said.
With sudden understanding, Leia half rose. Don't... Akbar touched the left breast of his pristine white uniform, fumbling with the catch as he removed his admiral's rank insignia.
I have caused enormous pain and suffering to the people of Vortex. I have brought immense embarrassment to the New Republic, and I have called down terrible shame upon myself. I hereby resign as commander of the New Republic fleet, effective immediately.
Under the pretense of testing a B-Wing fighter's response to extreme stress, Terpthen soared away from Coruscant. The other distraught Calamarian crewmen wished him luck before he departed, assuming he intended to continue his desperate work to clear Admiral Akbar's name. But just before the jump into hyperspace, Terpthen entered a new series of coordinates into the navicomputer. Star lines appeared around him, and the ship snapped into the incomprehensible swirl of hyperspace. Terpthen felt shudders pass through his body as he strained to resist the calling. But he knew by now, after all these years, that he could do nothing to fight it. Screaming nightmares never let him forget his ordeal in the hellish conditioning on the Imperial military training planet of Karida. The scars on his battered head were not just from torture, but from Imperial vivisection, where the doctors had sawed open his skull and scooped out portions of his brain. The cruel xenosurgeons had replaced the missing areas of Terpfin's brain with specially grown organic circuits that mimicked the composition of the removed tissue and could resist the most penetrating medical scan. They made him a helpless cyborg, a perfect spy and saboteur who could not think for himself when the Imperials wanted him to think their thoughts. After guiding his ship for several standard time units, Turpin pulled the levers that switched off the hyperdrive motors and kicked in the sublight engines. His ship hung near the lacy veil of the Kron Drift, the gaseous remnants of a multiple supernova. A dark Caridan ship already hung there, waiting for him. A burst of static came across Terpfen's comm system, then the tight-beam holo-transmission of Ambassador Fergan's head focused inside the B-Wing cockpit. His huge eyebrows looked like black feathers curling up on his forehead.
Well, my little fish, what is your report?
Terpfen tried to stop the words from coming, but the organic circuits kicked in.
I sabotaged Akbar's personal ship. And that should have meant death for both passengers, but even I underestimated Akbar's skill as a pilot.
Fergan scowled.
So, the mission failed.
On the contrary, I believe it is even more successful. The New Republic is far more affected by this chain of events than it would be if a simple crash had killed the Minister of State and the Admiral. Their fleet commander has now resigned in disgrace, and the ruling council is left without an obvious replacement.
Fergan considered for a moment, then nodded as a slow smile spread across his fat, dark lips. He changed the subject.
Have you made any progress in uncovering the location of the third Jedi baby?
Turpin answered in a steady, uninflected voice.
I have told you before, Ambassador, Anakin Solo is being held on a secret planet, the location of which is known only to Admiral Akbar and the Jedi Master Luke Skywalker. The boy's parents do not even know the location, and I think it highly unlikely that Akbar will divulge it in casual conversation.
Fergan looked as if he had just bit into something sour and wanted to spit it out.
Then what good are you?
Turpin would have taken no offense even if his organic circuitry had allowed him to.
I have set into motion another plan that may provide the information you seek.
Turpin had performed the task with parts of his mind he did not own. Flipper hands, moving, not of his own volition, had completed what the rest of him wanted to scream against.
Your plan had better work. And one last question. Tell me, how is dear Mon Mothma's health?
Fergin began to chuckle. Failing, Turpfin said, cursing himself. In the humid morning, the Jedi trainees gathered in the ship landing area to continue their exercises. Mists rose to the crown of the great temple. Sounds of the stirring jungle buzzed around the students as they practiced preposterous lessons to improve their supernatural balance, to encourage simple feats of levitation. Luke smiled as Kirana T and the young minstrel historian Tian joined forces. Laughing and concentrating, the two women lifted R2-D2 in the air as the little droid puttered about, clearing the ever-encroaching weeds from the landing grid. R2 vented electronic beeps and whistles as he floated, his treads spun in the air. Behind them, Gantoris emerged from the shadowy mouth of the temple, striding into the hazy light. Luke turned to watch him approach.
"Glad you could join us, Gantoris," he greeted him. "I have been preparing for a new test."
Gantoris reached into the folds of his robe. He removed a black cylinder. Luke blinked in astonishment at seeing a newly constructed lightsaber. R2 crashed to the ground as both Kirana T and Tian lost their concentration. The others ceased their lessons and stared in astonishment.
"Fight me, Master Skywalker."
"Where did you get a lightsaber?" Luke spoke cautiously, his mind whirling. None of his students should have been able to master the technology or the discipline yet. Gantoris fingered the controls on the handle. The glowing blade extended, a white incandescent core of energy fringed with deep violet. Gantoris moved his wrist, flicking the blade back and forth, testing it. A bone-vibrating hum scalded the air. "Isn't it the chest of a Jedi to build his own lightsaber?" Luke proceeded carefully. "The lightsaber may seem the simplest of weapons, but it is difficult to master. You aren't ready for this, Gantoris." But Gantoris stood like a weathered Masasi Colossus, holding the blazing edge of his lightsaber vertically in front of his face.
"If you don't ignite your lightsaber and fight me, I will cut you down right here."
Reluctantly, Luke shrugged out of his robe. He pulled his own lightsaber from the waist of his comfortable gray flight suit, and feeling the force thrum through him, ignited the yellow-green blade. The other trainees watched in amazed silence. Luke wondered how he could have miscalculated so greatly, how Gantoris had gained access to information that only an advanced student should have obtained. They crossed blades with a crackle of dissipating power, testing each other. Then, abandoning all pretense of testing, Gantoris launched himself at Luke, hacking and slashing. Luke blocked each blow, but fought only defensively to keep from provoking his student. Gantoris made no sound as he struck again and again. The lightsabers intersected with a flash of multicolored lightning. The fury in Gantoris astonished Luke, and he backed toward the jungle's edge, unnerved by the violence.
"Am I a Jedi now?"
Gantoris asked in a husky voice. Luke parried, then blocked another blow, locking both blades in a snapping, sizzling spray of discharged energy. He spoke through clenched teeth.
"A Jedi needs to know more than how to build a lightsaber. He must also learn how and when to use it."
Luke drove forward, suddenly taking the offensive. He struck and struck, careful not to injure Gantoris, but showing his mastery. When forced, the Jedi strikes quickly and decisively. He slashed down hard. Clumsily defending himself, Gantoris backed into a tangle of jungle. He swung and slashed wildly at Luke's lightsaber, using brute force but no finesse. Luke stood over him, intending to call an end to the duel, but Gantoris's eyes blazed brighter. As if springing a trap, he fingered a button on his lightsaber handle, and the violet-edged blade suddenly extended like a spear, flashing outward to nearly double its length. Luke jerked aside, and the point of Gantoris' energy blade slashed through the sleeve of his gray flight suit, leaving a smoldering gash. Not only had Gantoris built his own lightsaber, but he had constructed a blade with multiple jewels, allowing him to adjust the amplitude of his blade. Such a weapon was even more difficult to make than a traditional lightsaber. Without pausing, Gantoris pressed his advantage. Luke coiled his muscles, gathered his strength, and leapt upward. With a boost of his levitating ability, he soared high enough to reach a thick lower branch of the Masasi tree. He landed gently, keeping his balance as he looked down at the outraged Gantoris. Over the hum of lightsabers, he tried to break through Gantoris's intensity.
"How did you learn all this?"
The fiery-tempered man turned his face up, glaring with red-rimmed eyes.
"You are not the only teacher of the Jedi way."
Gantoris held his lightsaber with both hands and slashed sideways, sizzling through the massive trunk of the tree. The ancient tree shifted sideways, then crashed through clinging upper branches as it toppled.
Luke leapt free and landed easily in a rotting tangle of moss and fallen branches. He faked a stumble against a rock and lurched sideways toward a thicket. Gantoris charged after him, slashing vines out of the way. A startled, outraged Runyip charged out of the underbrush with an operatic range of bellows. The outburst distracted Gantoris for only a second. But Luke used the moment to reach out with the force. Grasping with invisible hands, he yanked the lightsaber out of Gantoris's grip and used his skill to push the button that deactivated the blade. Luke snatched Gantoris's weapon from the air and switched off his own lightsaber in his other hand. Suddenly, without the roaring hiss of dual blades, the jungle seemed disturbingly silent.
Good exercise, Gantoris. But you must learn to control your anger. It could be your undoing.
Through the simmering haze of a security field deep within the steel-crete mazes of Coruscant, Kip Duron looked at the thorn shape of the Sun Crusher. He squinted to get a better view, leaning forward until three heavily armed New Republic guards strode to bar his way. The three guards pointed their blaster rifles at his chest.
"This is a restricted area,"
the sergeant said.
"Leave immediately or we will shoot."
I'm Kip Duron. I flew the Sun Crusher with Han Solo from the Moa installation. I just wanted to have another look. The sergeant's stony expression did not change.
I have orders to restrict all access, no exceptions.
Kip shifted to one side to see between the guards. Kwee-Zooks had innocently designed a weapon that could trigger a star to explode, wiping out all life in an entire solar system. Kwee had done it as an exercise to test the limits of her scientific abilities. But Han had broken through her brainwashing and made her realize what she had created. She had then helped them steal the superweapon. Kip was glad the Sun Crusher was now in the hands of the New Republic, but it concerned him that the Senate couldn't decide what to do with it. Wedge Antilles watched with admiration as the beautiful and ethereal Kwee-Zooks stepped forward and prepared to address the New Republic Assembly. Kwee did not like to talk in front of an audience, and she had been nervous for days after setting up this speech. A solitary person, she had begun to confide in Wedge, now that he spent most of his time as her official bodyguard. Wedge had encouraged her, insisting that she would do a wonderful job. Kwee had looked at him gratefully. Her wide indigo eyes were in striking contrast to her pale blue skin and the gem-like cap of pearlescent feathers that draped from her head down to her shoulders. Now Kwee rested her blue gaze on Mon Mothma and the other ministers.
"The Sun Crusher is the most formidable weapon ever devised," Kwee said. "It is an order of magnitude more dangerous than even the Death Star. I have refused to divulge its workings for a reason, but you have kept it locked in your research bays for weeks, tinkering with it, studying it, trying to unlock its secrets. It will do you no good. I urge you to destroy the Sun Crusher. A weapon of such power should not be trusted in the hands of any government."
On the dais, Mon Mothma gazed wearily down at Kwee. Below and to her left, an older man spoke up.
Dr. Zooks, according to reports from our engineers, this weapon cannot be destroyed. The quantum armor makes it impossible for us even to dismantle it.
Senator Garm Bel-Iblis rose to his feet.
We cannot allow a weapon of such power to slip out of our grasp. With the Sun Crusher, we have a tactical advantage available to none of our Imperial enemies.
Enough, Mon Mothma said. We have debated this many times, and my opinion stands unchanged. A weapon of such destructive power is a brutal and inhuman device. The Emperor might have been monster enough to consider it, but under no circumstances will the New Republic be party to such barbarism. I shall veto any attempts to study the Sun Crusher further.
Kwee spoke up again.
Might I make a suggestion? Since the Sun Crusher cannot be destroyed by any normal means, I suggest we use the automatic pilot to send it into the heart of a sun, or at least to the core of a gas giant planet, where it will be impossible to recover.
Bel-Iblis looked around, his dark eyes flashing. As if sensing defeat and realizing that a gas giant was marginally more acceptable than the blinding fury of a star, he said,
All right, dump it into a gas giant then, for all the good it'll do.
Now that he was a hopeful colonist, Wharton got up in time to watch Dantooine's peaceful pastel sunrise. He stretched and stepped outside his prefab self-erecting home unit, enjoying every moment of dawn. He felt safe and at peace for the first time in his life, His bones ached, but it was a pleasant soreness from gratifying work. He would never recover completely from his hard life on the tortured world of Ilsha, but just spending a day without earthquakes or lava flows or scalding geysers made his life happy. The other colony units, made of brightly colored polymers, set with transparasteel windows, looked across the whispering savannas of Dantooine. All the people rescued from Ilsha agreed that this place seemed like paradise. The southeastern horizon grew bright where Dantooine's amber sun would rise. Overhead in the purplish skies, Wharton saw three brilliant stars moving against the other points of light. A cluster of six meteors streaked through the sky toward the horizon, their bright trails like slashes of claws. Then the supersonic screeching noise of their descent shattered the early morning stillness. The other colonists scrambled out of their huts, roused by the noise from the sky. Not far to the east, the empty ruins of the old rebel base rose like adobe bulwarks out of the grasses. A small team of New Republic construction engineers bustled about their encampment.
"What is it?"
his wife Glina asked as she stepped out of the dwelling to stand beside Wharton. He shook his head, unable to answer. Then deadly lightning began to rain down from above. Blinding bolts of green laser fire shot down, striking the abandoned base and ripping up huge clouds of fragmented buildings and shards of synthetic rock. Turbo laser beams from orbit flashed again, cutting across their earlier path. In seconds, they had obliterated the entire abandoned base, leaving only a smoldering, rubble-strewn scar. The colonists ran out of their dwelling. Some screamed, others just stared in stupefied terror. Luke Skywalker had promised he would find a place of safety for the people of Ilsha, but it seemed the Jedi had been mistaken.
"You're sure nothing is left alive down there?"
Admiral Dalla asked Commander Kratos.
"Nothing, Admiral. No structure is left standing. The place is a wasteland."
"Good. I believe we've made our point," Dalla smiled. "Next time we'll choose a more important world to strike."
The sleep of a Jedi was rarely troubled by dreams. Pure rest, brought about through concentration and meditation techniques, left little room for disturbing thoughts or shadow plays. But this time nightmares did break through to Luke Skywalker. A voice called him across a misty, blank dreamscape.
"Luke. Luke, my son. You must hear me."
A shadowy form rose out of the mists. Even as the surroundings began to sharpen, Luke saw himself in his pale gray flight suit, stained with sweat, grime, and pain, as he had looked when he took his father's body from the second Death Star. The features on the spectral silhouette shimmered with a pale aura. Luke saw the firm face of Anakin Skywalker, restored from the ravages Darth Vader's evil had worked on his body.
"Father!"
Luke called. He was surprised to find that his own voice had an odd, echoing quality.
"Luke!"
Luke felt tingling amazement surge through him. It was another sending, just like his last contact from Obi-Wan Kenobi.
"Father, why are you here?"
Anakin stood taller. His robes rippled in a rising wind that drove back the mists. Suddenly the world surrounding them was no longer featureless. Luke recognized that he and the image of his father stood atop the great temple on Yavin 4. The orange gas giant hung overhead, and the timeless jungles below looked unchanged. But the stones of the temple were white and new with bright scars from fresh quarrying. A sketchy framework of scaffolding laced one wall of the ziggurat. Far below, Luke heard mumbling and chanting, incantations from suffering slaves. He saw people of the vanished Masasi race laboring together, straining to haul enormous stone blocks along the roads they had chopped through the jungle. The grayish-green Masasi were humanoid, smooth-skinned, with large lantern-like eyes. Anakin Skywalker stood on the highest point of the temple as if directing the work gangs below.
"Do not be deceived, Luke. Do not trust everything you think to be the truth."
Luke felt uneasiness well up within him. His father spoke of Obi-Wan. Luke knew the old man had not always been completely forthcoming with him.
"Yes, I know Obi-Wan hid the truth from me." "Obi-Wan wanted you to be his student, but he wouldn't allow you the freedom to make your own decisions. Did he trust you so little? Did you always agree with his certain point of view?"
"No," Luke said, feeling the words swallowed up in doubt.
"Obi-Wan fought against the complex Sith teachings I had uncovered. He did not understand them himself, but he forbade me to study them, though he always insisted that I must learn for myself.
I rebelled against him for his narrow-mindedness, and I insisted on unlocking secrets for which I was not ready. In the end, it consumed me. I fell to the dark side, and I became the Dark Lord of the Sith.
Anakin looked at Luke with an anguished, apologetic expression.
But if Obi-Wan had let me learn the teachings at my own pace, I would have grown stronger. I would have remained uncorrupted. He never understood that.
Anakin shook his head.
If you are going to teach other Jedi, Luke, you must understand the consequences of what they may learn. You, too, must study the ancient heritage of the Sith.
Luke stiffened, unable to believe what his father was saying. Then he noticed that with the rising passion in his voice, the image of Anakin Skywalker became less distinct, wavering, until it transformed into only a black outline, an engulfing hooded form that sucked energy from the air. Slowly, Luke realized the truth.
You are not my father.
The illusion began to crumble.
My father was a good man in the end, healed by the light side. Who are you? Who?
The dark man's silhouette grew larger and larger, swallowing up the sky. Luke backed away from it, but he reached the edge of the temple and stumbled backward, falling away, falling. Surrounded by the thick stone walls of his quarters, Gantoris did not even attempt to sleep. He sat on his bunk, dreading the arrival of the dark man from his nightmares. He fingered the lightsaber he had constructed, feeling its smooth cylinder, the rough spots where he had welded the pieces together, the buttons that would activate the energy blade. He wondered how he could use it against the ancient specter who had taught him things that terrified him, things that Master Skywalker would never show to his Jedi trainees.
Do you mean to strike me down with that weapon?
Ganturus whirled to see the oily, infinitely black silhouette ooze out of the massive stones in the wall.
What do you want with me? You don't just want to teach me.
The Shadow Man agreed.
I want your anger, Ganturus. I want you to open the doorways of power. I am barred from the physical plane. But with enough other Sith followers, I could be at peace. I could even live again.
Ganturus swallowed, searching for a core of strength within himself.
I won't let you have my anger. A Jedi does not give in to anger. There is no passion. There is serenity. Serenity! Let me show you what is happening at this moment. Do you recall the people you saved from Irsha? How happy you were to learn they had been taken to a place of safety. A paradise world. Observe.
Inside the black cutout form of the hooded man, an image appeared, displaying the grasslands of the planet Dantooine. But now Gantoris saw Imperial lasers striking down, leveling colony buildings, giant armored walkers striding across the savannah, blasting anything that moved, igniting the temporary living units. People ran, screaming.
His people! No! Let loose your anger. Make me stronger. No!
Gantoris turned his head away from the images of burned ruins and blackened bodies.
They are all dead. All of them. No survivors.
Gantoris ignited his lightsaber and lunged at the dark man. Luke snapped awake. He heard a disturbance coming down the hall, clumsy footsteps slapping on the stone floor, panicked shouts. The cloned alien Dorsk 81 rushed into his room, shouting,
Master Skywalker, you must come immediately!
They ran down the flagstone corridors, up the turbo lift, and into the trainees' living quarters. A sour, smoky stench filled the air, and Luke felt an icy lump in his stomach as he pushed cautiously forward. Hard-bitten Cam Solusar and addled Streen both stood outside the open doorway to Gantoris' quarters, looking pasty and ill. Luke hesitated for a fraction of a second, then moved through the doorway. Inside the small stone chamber, he saw what was left of Gantoris. The body lay crisped and blackened on the floor, burned from the inside out. Singed stains on the flagstones showed where he had thrashed about in the conflagration. Gantoris' skin flaked in black, peeling ashes over his powdery bones. Rising wisps of steam curled from the remaining fabric of his Jedi robe. On the floor, the newly constructed lightsaber lay where Gantoris had dropped it, as if he had tried to fight something and lost.
By now the other trainees had gathered. Luke applied a Jedi calming technique before he felt confident enough to trust his voice. The words tasted like wet ash in his mouth. "Beware the dark side," he said. After 8 seemingly random hyperspace jumps to shake any possible pursuit, Akbar took a borrowed B-wing fighter along the correct vector to the hidden planet Anoth. For years, isolated Anoth had been a haven for the Jedi children, protected by its perfect obscurity and anonymity. The twins, Jason and Jaina, had gone home to Coruscant only a month or two before, but the youngest child, 1-year-old baby Anakin, remained under the protection of Leia's devoted servant Winter, far from prying Imperial eyes or dark side influences that could corrupt the baby's fragile, force-sensitive mind. Akbar brought his B-wing in on close approach through the deep purple skies of Anoth. Sparks discharged from the wing of his fighter, but he felt no threat. This was not like flying through the storms of Vortex. He sent a brief signal to inform Winter of his arrival, but he did not respond to her surprise or her questions. Switching off the fighter's comm unit, he rehearsed how he would tell her all that had happened. Then he concentrated on guiding the B-Wing in for a landing. Akbar sat eating a meal of reconstituted rations that Winter had somehow managed to make palatable. As he told her every detail of the tragedy on Vortex and how he had resigned from his service, Winter did not appear judgmental. She simply listened. Baby Anakin crouched on Akbar's lap, cooing and reaching up in curiosity to pat his clammy skin and touch his huge glassy eyes. Anakin giggled as Akbar's round eyes swiveled in various directions to avoid being poked by pudgy fingers. Winter hesitated and then spoke in a voice that seemed less able to conceal emotion than it normally did. "Akbar, you know I have the greatest respect for your abilities. It would honor me if you would stay here with me instead of going into hiding on your homeworld." Akbar finally managed to speak, giving his answer before he could change his mind.
"Your offer honors me, Winter, but I am not worthy, at least not at the moment. I must go to Calamari and search for peace there. If I..."
The words caught in his throat again, and he realized he was trembling.
"If I find my peace, perhaps I shall return to you and the baby."
"I will be here waiting if you change your mind," she said, then escorted him back to the hangar grotto. Back on Coruscant, Terpfen lay sick and shivering in his private quarters, trying with all his might to resist. But in the end, the organic circuitry inside what was left of his brain took over. Moving with forced steps, he descended to the dispatching and receiving network in the lower levels of the old Imperial Palace. No one watched him in the crowded room as diplomatic droids and packages came in and left. Terpfen coded his secret message, summarizing information he had received from the hidden tracking device he had planted on Akbar's ship. He sealed the message inside a coffin-sized hyperspace courier tube and shielded the entire apparatus. He keyed in Admiral Akbar's personal diplomatic security code, which would allow it to bypass all checks and tariff points. No one would have thought to revoke Akbar's access yet. The routing doors opened up at the far end of the center, and the silvery message canister rose on its launching field. In a reflex action, Terpfen reached out, trying to grasp the slick sides of the canister, scraping with the sharp points of his hands. But the container rocketed out, picking up speed as it soared into the Coruscant sky. Terpfen had programmed 5 alternate routes to discourage tracking. The message canister would arrive unhindered and without delay at the Imperial Military Academy on Carida.
"You'll do just fine, kid," Han Solo said, trying to maintain his roguish grin.
Standing at the door of Han and Leia's quarters, Kip Duron nodded. Han noticed a faint trembling around the young man's lips.
"I'll do my best, Han, you know that."
Suddenly unable to say another word, Han embraced Kip, silently cursing stinging tears that rose to his eyes.
"You'll be the greatest Jedi ever."
"I doubt that," Kip said.
He broke away and averted his face, but not before Han caught the shimmer of tears in his eyes, too.
"Thanks, Han, for everything. But I've got to be going. General Antilles is escorting the Sun Crusher to Yavin, and I'll be going with him. He'll drop me off at Luke's Academy. See you around."
"Sure, kid."
Han watched as the young man walked with a feigned bouncy step to the turbolift. After Kip had gone, Han returned to the lounge where he and Lando had played sabacc for possession of the Falcon. Han soon lost himself in thought, wondering where he had come to,
thinking about how much his life had changed since his years as a spice smuggler for Jabba the Hutt, and then as a general in the Rebel Alliance. He continued to do important things with his life, but it just didn't seem as real anymore. He had enjoyed spending time with young Kip Duron. The young man reminded him so much of himself when he was young.
You're gonna miss that kid, aren't you?
Han looked up to see Lando Calrissian standing over him with a big smile.
What are you doing here?
Han said grumpily.
Buying you a drink, old buddy.
Lando pulled up a chair. I didn't invite you to sit down.
Look, Han, when you won the Falcon from me in a Sabacc game, did I spend years pouting and not talking to you?
Han shrugged.
I don't know. I pretty much stayed away all those years.
And the next time we saw each other, you betrayed us to Darth Vader.
Hey, that wasn't my fault, and I've more than made up for it since. Listen, I got a deal for you. Next time you get a chance, why don't the both of us take the Falcon and go back to what's left of Kessel? Maybe we can find my old ship there. If we do, I'll gladly take the Lady Luck back, and you can have the Falcon.
He held out his broad hand.
Deal? All right, pal.
Han shook Lando's hand.
Solo,
a woman's sharp voice said.
They told me I'd find you here.
Oh, can't a guy get some peace?
Han turned to see a trim, attractive woman standing at the lounge entrance. She had shoulder-length reddish-brown hair, the color of some exotic spice. Her features were finely chiseled. The shards of ice that were once Mara Jade's eyes had warmed somewhat since the last time Han had seen her.
Lando stood up, sweeping his cape behind him and extending his hand. Well, hello. Please join us, Miss Jade. May I get you anything? We've met before, but I'm...
Shut up, Calrissian. I need to talk to Solo.
Lando laughed and went to get her a drink anyway. Mara Jade had been the Emperor's hand, a special servant to Palpatine himself, and she had seen her life crumble after his death. She had blamed Luke for that and had held a vendetta against him until recently. Now, after the retirement of her most recent boss, the great smuggler Talon Card, Mara seemed more ready to participate in broader events.
What brings you back to Coruscant, Mara?
Han asked.
I'm bringing a message. You can pass it on to the appropriate people. Your Imperial friend Admiral Dalla has been sending out feelers, trying to hire smugglers as spies and saboteurs. A few have taken the offer, but I don't expect many of them to trust Dalla after what she did to the forces of Kessel.
We got a message that she had attacked a supply ship and destroyed it before it could get to Dantooine.
Mara looked at him and her gaze became hard again.
Haven't you heard what happened to your colony on Dantooine?
Dalla's already been there, you know.
What?
Dantooine has been leveled. Every person in your colony and all of your New Republic engineers are dead as of 2 days ago.
You came here just to give us this information? Han said, trying to recover from his shock.
Mara shrugged. I have an agreement with the New Republic, and I keep my agreements.
As Han felt anger starting to boil inside him at what Dalla had done, Lando came back and changed the subject.
So, where are you off to now, Miss Jade?
He said. Leaning forward on the table, he seemed to be trying to melt her with his big brown eyes.
Mara looked at him as if considering how much effort it was worth for her to answer his question.
I'll be leaving immediately, she said.
I'm going to spend some time at Skywalker's Jedi Training Center. It makes good business sense to learn how to use my Jedi abilities, if only for self-protection.
Han sat up in surprise.
You're going to learn from Luke? I thought you still hated Luke. You've tried to kill him often enough.
Mara's eyes blazed for an instant. Then she softened and even smiled.
We've reconciled our differences.
You might say we negotiated a mutual truce, for now, at least, she added, and then smiled even more.
She stood up to leave. Thanks for your time, Solo.
Ignoring Lando completely, she walked out of the lounge. The next night, Leia had just sat down to cherish a relaxing meal with her husband and her children, when a summons from Mon Mothma arrived. She opened their front door to find a hovering messenger droid bobbing up and down in the corridor.
Minister Leia Organa Solo, Chief of State Mon Mothma, requests your presence immediately in her private quarters for an important consultation. Please follow me.
Back at the table, Han rolled his eyes and glowered at no one in particular as Leia was taken from him again. Mon Mothma's quarters were dark. Too dark. lit only by soft greenish lamps designed to be soothing, restful, healing. The air was filled with the sweet tang of odd medicines and the clinging aftertaste of sickness.
Mon Mothma? Leia said.
Ah, Leia.
Mon Mothma looked gaunt and skeletal as she lay on a broad bed surrounded by diagnostic equipment. On Mon Mothma's dressing table sat an array of makeup jars and synthetic skin-coloring agents.
Thank you for coming. I can't keep my secret any longer. I must tell you everything.
Han had not had time to put the twins to bed before Leia returned.
I didn't expect you back till late. Did Mon Mothma let you off the hook? Han said.
When she turned to him, he saw that she was trying not to cry.
What is it?
She's dying, Han. She has some sort of mysterious wasting disease. The medic droids have never seen anything like it. It's almost as if something is taking her apart genetically from the inside. At the rate the disease is taking over, she could be dead in less than a month. Han didn't know what to say.
What does this mean? What do you have to do?
Leia came forward and hugged him. He held her close. She said, with Mon Mothma weakening and Admiral Ackbar in exile, the moderate side of the Council will be gone. I can't let the New Republic turn into an aggressor government. We've already suffered too much. Now is the time for us to strengthen our ties, to make the New Republic firm through political alliances with planetary systems joining with us, not to go blasting leftover Imperial strongholds in this sector of the galaxy.
Now, let me guess who wants to do that,
Han said, thinking of a number of the old generals who had reveled in their days of glory during the major battles of the rebellion.
I have to bring Ackbar back, Leia said.
Small but infinitely deadly, the Sun Crusher superweapon entered orbit around the gas giant of Yavin, flying side by side with the armored New Republic transport. Sitting in the streamlined pilot's seat, Kip Duran felt the Sun Crusher's advanced controls respond to his fingertips. He stared through the segmented viewport at the eddying orange planet below, a waiting, bottomless pit where the Sun Crusher would be buried forever.
Ready to send her down, Kip?
The voice of Wedge Antilles crackled over the comm unit.
Straight line plunge.
Kip fingered the controls, feeling a chill of reluctance. The Sun Crusher was such a perfect weapon. But he also knew that Kwee-Zooks was right and that the temptation to use such power would eventually corrupt anyone. He adjusted the sublight course vectors. I'm setting the nav systems now. Prepare to dock. Kwee's voice interrupted his thoughts.
Make certain all power systems are shut down and seal the containment field.
Kip flicked a row of switches. Already done. He heard the muffled thump of hull against hull as Wedge brought the armored transport against the Sun Crusher.
Magnetic field's in place, Kip. Open the hatch and come on over.
Setting the timer. Kip activated the autopilot, dimmed the lights in the cockpit, and clambered toward the small hatch. He opened it, and Wedge helped him into the transport. They sealed the Sun Crusher behind them, then disengaged the docking connection. Wedge moved back to the pilot's seat of the armored transport and flopped into the cockpit chair beside Kwee-Zooks. Kwee sat strapped in with crash restraints. She was obviously filled with anxiety. Wedge nudged the attitude control thrusters and swung the armored transport around so they could watch. The elongated crystal shape of the Sun Crusher increased its distance, drifting closer to the gravitational jaws of Yavin. Finally, the superweapon dwindled to a mere speck approaching the chaotic storms of Yavin. Kip saw the shape plunge into the upper atmosphere, plowing down on its unalterable course toward the planetary core. He imagined the Sun Crusher streaking deeper and deeper into the dense atmosphere. Scorching heat generated by atmospheric friction would throw off ripples and sonic booms as the Sun Crusher went down, down to the gas giant's diamond-thick core.
Well, we never have to worry about that thing again, Wedge said.
Wedge ignited the thrusters of the armored transport and arced them away from close orbit to the fringes of the system of moons.
Kwee and I are due to go inspect the reparation work on Vortex. Still want to go down to the jungle moon, Kip?
Kip nodded. Yes. Master Skywalker is waiting for me. Staring out the observation window of an orbiting way station high above the planet of Calamari, Leia thought the Calamarian shipyards looked even more impressive than their reputation had led her to expect. The starship construction facilities rode high above the mottled blue planet. Supply platforms sprawled in three dimensions, dotted with winking red, yellow, and green lights that indicated landing pads and docking bays. Small girder impellers pushed huge mounds of plasteel. The girders would be used in the frameworks of the famous Mon Calamari star cruisers.
Excuse me, Minister Organa Solo?
Leia turned to see a small Calamarian female wearing pale blue ambassadorial robes. While the males had bulbous and lumpy heads, the females were more streamlined with olive-colored mottling over the pale salmon of their hides.
I am Silgal.
The Calamarian female raised both of her webbed hands. Leia raised her own hand in acknowledgement. Thank you for meeting me, Ambassador. I appreciate your help. The ambassador stepped forward to gesture out at the bustling space dock facility.
I see you have been observing our work on the Star Tide. It will be our first addition to the New Republic fleet in many months. We have been devoting most of our resources to recovering from last year's attack by the Emperor's World Devastators.
Leia nodded, looking again at the splotchy organic shape of the Mon Calamari star cruiser. She tore her gaze from the activity and nodded at the ambassador. As always, I am astonished at the resourcefulness and dedication of the Calamarians. You have given so much after your enslavement by the Empire, after the attacks you've suffered. I feel reluctant to ask for further help, but I desperately need to speak with Admiral Akbar. Silgal straightened her sky-blue robes.
We have respected Akbar's request for privacy and his need for contemplation after the tragedy on Vortex. But our people remain proud of him and support him entirely. If you wish to bring further charges against...
No, no, Leia said. I've come to beg him to return.
In that case, a shuttle is ready to take you down.
Leia gripped the widely spaced arms of the passenger seat as Silgal maneuvered the egg-shaped shuttle through sleeting rain and knotted gray storm clouds. The vessel curved away from small, marshy islands, sparse dots of habitable land where the amphibious Calamarians had first established their civilizations. Through the mists and the whipping spray, Leia watched them approach the metal island of Foam Wander City. The bright lights of thousands of above-surface windows shed jewels of light even through the whipping rain. Below the hemispherical dome, Leia knew that the floating cities had underwater towers and descending complexes like the mirror image of a Coruscant skyline. Starved for raw materials on their marshy islands, the Mon Calamari had not been able to build a civilization until they joined forces with another intelligent species that lived beneath the oceans. The Quarren, a humanoid race with helmet-shaped heads and faces that looked like a fistful of tentacles sprouting beneath close-set eyes, had excavated metallic ores from the ocean crust. Working with the Calamarians, they built dozens of floating cities. Though the Quarren could also breathe air, they chose to remain under the sea, while the Calamarians designed starships to explore the bright islands in space. After they entered the upper level of the city and docked their craft, Silgal led Leia to a turbolift that plunged them down into the city's deep underwater levels. When they emerged, the lighting was dim and shimmering. A jewel blue reflected through faceted glow lamps and thick transparisteel windows that looked out into the ocean depths. Following a ramp downward, they emerged into an open equipment bay that had been pressurized to allow easy access to the water. Quarren, dressed in sleek black suits, were diving through access fields into the watery depths. Silgal went to a row of small porcelain compartments and opened one. She removed a pair of the slithery suits worn by the diving Quarren, handing one to Leia. Leia ran her fingers over the fabric. It seemed alive, clinging and slippery at the same time. The tiny mesh expanded and contracted as if seeking an appropriate shape to best serve the wearer. Silgal indicated a closet-sized door, and Leia stepped inside, sealing the door behind her as blue-green illumination intensified in the small chamber. She disrobed and slid into the black suit, feeling her skin tingle as the fabric adjusted, trying to conform. When the crawly sensation stopped, it was the most comfortable garment she had ever worn. Warm yet cool, light yet insulating, fuzzy yet slick. When Leia emerged, Silgal stood outside the door, already wearing her water garment. Without speaking, she fitted a water jetpack over Leia's shoulders. Then she dipped her broad hands into a bubbling urn. She pulled out a floppy, translucent sheet and held it up. Water streamed off its surface, fizzing with tiny bubbles.
Humans sometimes find this unpleasant. I apologize.
Silgal slapped the gelatinous mass across Leia's mouth and nose. The membrane was cold and wet, clinging to her cheeks, her skin. Leia stiffened in alarm and tried to struggle, but the strange, soft gel stuck fast to her face. Starved for air, Leia tried to suck in a deep breath and found herself inhaling clean, ozone-smelling air. Pure oxygen filled her lungs, and as she breathed slowly out, the bubbles percolated back through the membrane. Silgal handed Leia a pair of small devices. The microphone slid into the gelatinous membrane, but was held firmly. When she put the second jack into her ear, Silgal's voice came through clearly.
The symbiote you're wearing filters oxygen from the sea. It can last for weeks underwater.
As they jetted through the water, Leia felt warm currents on her forehead and around her eyes. The symbiote fed her a steady supply of air, and the fine mesh suit kept her warm and dry and comfortable. She remained close beside Silgal as their jetpacks bubbled and streamed. Suddenly, Leia froze as she saw a deadly sleek form like an Imperial attack ship above. An enormous living creature with a long, bullet-shaped body, spined fins, a mouth filled with fangs. On either side of the mouth streamed whipping tentacles, each tipped with razor-jawed pincers. Leia began to swim frantically backward. Silgal grabbed her shoulder and pulled her down.
Trekana, it won't find us.
Silgal sounded altogether too calm. Fish swam frantically away from the torpedo shape of the predator. Silgal seemed to be concentrating.
No, it will get that one.
She gestured with one large hand.
The blue and yellow striped keeler. After that, it will take the smaller orange one in the middle of the school. By then, all the others will have fled, and the Krakana will continue on its way. Then we can leave.
How do you know that?
I know. It's a little trick I have.
Leia watched in horrified fascination as the Krakana streaked forward, coming unexpectedly from below as it reached out with its mass of tentacles to grab the blue and yellow keeler and rip it to ragged shreds before stuffing its fang-filled mouth. By the time the monster had grabbed the pale orange fish, the rest of the school had fled. Leia stared at Silgal, amazed at her prescience, but the Calamarian ambassador squeezed Leia's upper arm before igniting her water jetpack.
Now we must go find Akbar.
Leia and Silgal swam closer to the choppy surface until they reached a place where leathery sea trees, veined with iridescent blue and red, swirled in the churning current stirred by the continuing storm.
When Akbar was younger, he had a small dwelling here in the wild sea tree thickets.
Ahead, Leia saw a spherical dwelling made of plasteel, covered with algae and draping weed that had grown up from a spray clinging to its hull. Large valves of water recirculation equipment, desalination devices, and round viewports dotted the open spaces on the curved walls. A bare deck looked clean and bright as if recently scrubbed. They stroked down through the water. Thick sea tree trunks anchored the dwelling module in place, rocking it from side to side. On the bottom of the hull, they found an opening. Silgal went first through the containment field and Leia followed. When her head plunged through into the dim interior, she stripped off the symbiote, shook herself, and looked around Akbar's cluttered home. He stood up in alarm from a bench made of pitted flowstone, speechless as Silgal and Leia eased themselves out of the water. They stood silently staring at each other for a long moment. Finally, Leia spoke. Admiral Akbar, I'm glad we found you. Later they sat finishing bowls of simple but delicious fish stew. Leia chewed on the tender meat, swallowed another mouthful, and licked her lips to taste the burning sweet tingle of Calamarian spices. "We need you back, Admiral," Leia said. Leia had told him the whole story of Mon Mothma's illness, and now she leaned on Akbar's small table and stared at him, her dark eyes pleading.
"I'm sorry, Leia."
Akbar shook his head. He indicated the newly refurbished workroom and his equipment.
"I have important work to do here. My planet was badly damaged during the Imperial attacks, and there have been many tectonic disturbances. I've taken it upon myself to find out if our planet's crust has become unstable. No more lives will be lost because of me. I was just preparing to set some new seismic sensors."
He shuffled toward a shelf filled with packaged electronic equipment.
"Please, leave me in peace."
Leia stood up quickly. "We'll help you set out your sensors, Admiral." Akbar hesitated as if lonely but afraid to have their company. He turned to meet Leia's eyes, then Silgal's.
"Yes. I would be honored to have your assistance."
Strapped into one of the seats in the cramped utility sub, Leia watched as water sloshed around the upper ports. The sea swallowed the craft, and they descended into the isolated sea tree forest until the ocean around them looked like panels of dark green smoked glass. Akbar picked a course through thick, ropey strands and wide pillars.
I have only begun deploying my seismic network. I've set up the baseline grid beneath my dwelling, but I need to extend into the C3 forest to get higher resolution soundings.
Silgar said, I am pleased with the important work you're doing for our planet, Admiral.
It is necessary to do important things with your life,
Akbar said. Then said no more, walling himself off in silence. Leia cleared her throat. Akbar, I understand how you must feel, but you can't hide on Calamari forever. Akbar would not look at her.
I'm not hiding. I have my work, important work.
Sugal interrupted, leaning forward to indicate some curved, half-buried sections of metal, like the ribbed shell of some sort of escape pod. What's that? The edges had corroded, and tracings of algae grew in the protected crevices.
Perhaps a wrecked ship, Akbar said.
He inserted his hands into the Waldo control gloves for the automated metallic claws that extended from the front of the small sub. Watching the external metal arms, Leia saw Akbar remove a canister from the external storage bin on the submersible. The nimble robotic claws positioned the cylinder upright in the soft sand. Reversing propellers, Akbar lifted them away. Craning his neck so that he could see better through the front viewport, Akbar pushed the activate button. With a vibrating thump that Leia could feel through the sub's hull, the seismic canister detonated its tiny explosive. A long rod plunged deep into the ocean floor while spraying out a web of secondary detectors symmetrically around the core like a shooting star. Akbar peered into his widely set stereoscopic sensor displays.
Oh, this is interesting.
What is it?
Another large metallic mass tangled in the weeds right above us.
Akbar eased the sub ahead. As Leia saw the outline of a large, multi-legged thing wrapped with sea trees and overgrown with algae, she thought it was some kind of alien life form. Then she recognized the squashed elliptical head, the segmented body core trailing jointed mechanical arms, its non-reflective black surface. She had seen something like this on the ice planet Hoth, when Han Solo and Chewbacca had stumbled upon the Imperial probe droid. Admiral?
I see it. Arakeed Viper Series Probot. The Empire dispatched thousands to all corners of the galaxy to hunt down rebel bases.
It must have landed years ago on Calamari, Silgal said. The wreckage we found below was its landing pod. Akbar nodded.
But when the probe droid tried to rise to the surface, it tangled in the seaweed. It must have shut down.
He nudged the sub closer, shining his depth light on the outer surface. But when the beam struck the probot's rounded head, its entire bank of round eyes blinked to life. It's been activated, Leia said. She could hear the high-pitched, vibrating hum of powerful generators as the probe droid began to move again. The head swiveled and directed its own glowing beam at the sub. Akbar pushed the propellers into reverse, but before the sub could move away, the probot launched out with its spider-like claws. Mechanical arms latched onto one of the sub's rounded fins. Akbar threw all the sub's power into pulling away, and succeeded only in yanking the probe droid along with him, tearing it free of ancient strands of weed. Through the speakers of the comm unit, a sudden static-filled burst of subspace gibberish blasted out from the probe droid in some kind of powerful coded signal. The long chain of data shouted toward space, even as the deadly probot wrestled with Akbar's sub. The black droid finally succeeded in rotating its head, bending its laser cannons toward the sub. Akbar fired the lateral jets, wrenching them and the probe droid sideways as a volley of vicious laser blasts screamed past them, plowing a tunnel of sudden steam through the water. He tugged at the Waldos and brought another of his equipment arms to bear, a small cutting laser. Its tip heated to incandescent red-white as he slashed through the probe droid's gripping metal claw, severing the plasteel and breaking them free. Leia knew it was hopeless. They couldn't get away, and the cutting laser would do nothing against the far superior weapons of the probot. And unlike Luke, she had not mastered Jedi skills enough to mount even a feeble defense. But Akbar, still looking cool and in control, fired two blasts from the cutting laser at the head of the probe droid, attempting to blind its optical sensors. The feeble beam struck. The probot detonated in an unexpected explosion. The shock wave rang against the hull of the sub. It self-destructed, Silgar said. Leia remembered Han's conjecture on Hoth. The probe droids have programming to destroy themselves rather than risk letting their data fall into enemy hands.
The probot sent its signal before it self-destructed, Silgal observed.
Leia felt a cold fist of fear close around her stomach, but Akbar tried to dismiss the peril.
This probe droid has been here for 10 years or more, and that would have been a very old code, almost certainly obsolete.
Even if the Imperials could still understand its message, who would be out there listening?
With her three Imperial Star Destroyers safely hidden among the ionized islands of the Cauldron Nebula, Admiral Dalla had retired to her private quarters to review tactics when the door chime interrupted her. Commander Kratos stood stiffly at her door. He was trying to mask a smug grin of satisfaction, but the expression displayed itself in a small facial tick and the slight upturn of his thin lips.
"Yes, Commander, what is it?" Dalla said.
"We've intercepted a signal," Kratos said. "It appears to be from an Imperial probe droid, transmitting covert data gathered on an important rebel planet called Calamari, the site of one of their prime starship building facilities."
Dalla raised her eyebrows.
"Excellent, Commander. We've been looking for a new target to strike, and if this is an important starship construction facility, that sounds like a good candidate."
Leia piloted Akbar's open-canopied wavespeeder as they rushed over the oceans of Calamari. As they approached the lumpy hemisphere of Foam Wander City, it looked like a gunmetal gray island. Other small sea skimmers drifted in and out, gathering up nets and dashing back to access openings. Akbar sat up stiffly.
"Listen."
An all-hands alarm could be heard over the rushing noise of the wind and waves. Leia grabbed the comm unit, punching buttons for Foam Wander City control. "This is Wavespeeder 17017. What is the cause of the alarm?" Before Leia could receive an answer, a curtain of brilliant light sliced through the clouds, slashing the ocean surface near the floating city.
"Those are turbo lasers,"
Leia said. Akbar gripped the side of his seat.
"We're being fired on from orbit."
Overhead, like a flock of razor-winged carrion birds, came an entire squadron of TIE fighters and TIE bombers. They swooped down in a steep descent with a roaring howl of their twin ion engines. The TIE bombers released glowing energy packets that exploded in the sea, sending out great shockwaves and foam and spray. TIE fighters roared over Foam Wander City, strafing it with their laser cannons. Akbar piloted them quickly into one of the city's tunnel entrances. In the serpentine corridors, lights flashed and groups of Quarren rushed past. Leia had no doubt they were abandoning the city structure, swimming down to where they thought they were safe.
"Akbar!"
Several Calamarians echoed, stepping aside to allow him passage.
"Admiral Akbar!"
Akbar seemed taller now without the haunted look he had worn since the crash on Vortex. Leia knew that all Calamarians remembered the nightmare of Imperial attacks, but if anyone could mount a successful defense with what little resources they had, it would be Akbar. After the turbolift spilled them out onto the proper level, Ambassador Silgal led the way. She used her diplomatic access codes to let them into the core of Foam Wander City until they finally emerged into the chaotic central command. Seven Calamarian technical experts sat at command stations watching the battle overhead. In the center of the room, a holographic wireframe diagram of the planet and its moon hovered amidst sparkling pinpoints of fighters flying in defensive formation.
"Give me a tactical update,"
Akbar said, stepping to the holographic projection.
"Silgal,"
Leia said, "get me to the comm system. I can use my priority codes to send for New Republic military assistance. On a low frequency, the codes can punch through any interference from those star destroyers." Leia hurried to the comm station Silgal pointed out to her and punched in the override codes to send a tight beam encoded signal directly to Coruscant.
"This is Minister Leia Organa Solo. The planet Calamari is currently under attack by two Imperial Star Destroyers. We request immediate assistance. Repeat, immediate assistance. If you don't get here soon, don't bother to come."
The city commander thrust a webbed hand into the holographic display of the battle.
"Reposition the entire squadron of B-Wing fighters to defend the shipyards because we thought that would be the most likely target. But when the Star Destroyers came out of hyperspace, they went into orbit and began an assault on the floating cities."
"Commander,"
one of the Calamarian tacticians spoke up,
"we've lost all contact with Reef Home. Static signature analysis implies that the entire city has been destroyed."
A quiet moan of dismay rippled through Central Command. The city commander said tentatively,
"I was about to withdraw defenses from the shipyards to attack the Star Destroyers."
Akbar looked at the swarms of B-Wing fighters still harrying the Imperial fighters.
"Good decision, Commander."
But he stared intently at the map, at the moon, at the two Star Destroyers on the far side of the planet.
"Wait a moment. Something looks very familiar to me."
He nodded slowly, as if his great head were too heavy for his shoulders.
"Yes. Commander, withdraw the B-Wing fighters, all of them. Send them to fight the Star Destroyers. Leave the shipyards entirely undefended."
"Is that wise, Admiral?"
Leia asked.
"No, it is a trap."
Akbar pointed a flipper hand into the images of the two Star Destroyers.
"The Grand Moff Tarkin is dead, but I recognize his trick. I know what the Imperial Commander plans to do. Do we have a sensor network on the far side of the moon?
No, Admiral, the city commander said. We had considered it years ago, but
I didn't think so. So we're blind there, correct?
Correct. What are you getting at, Admiral? Leia said.
There's a third Star Destroyer hiding behind our moon.
The others turned to him in amazement.
What proof do you have? The actions of the Imperial Commander tell me all I need. Their main target is indeed the shipyards. Moments after these two Star Destroyers came out of hyperspace, a third also emerged, concealed in the shadow of our moon. The Vanguard attack is designed to lure us away from the shipyards, tricking us into throwing our entire defenses against a feint. When the third Star Destroyer comes in at full sublight speed, the shipyards will be helpless. With one run, the third Star Destroyer can obliterate our starship assembly facilities with virtually no losses of its own.
But, Admiral, the city commander said, why did you just withdraw all of our forces from the shipyards?
Because you are going to give me remote command of that ship.
Gesturing toward the holographic display, Akbar indicated the huge space dock hangar, where the skeletal hull of the new battlecruiser Startide hung in orbit.
But, sir, none of the Startide's weapons are functional.
But its engines work, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, we tested the sublight engines only last week.
Then give me remote operations.
Taking control, Akbar stepped into a field where virtual images were projected with a parallax designed for widely set telescopic eyes. The half-constructed ship powered up its engines and locked into drone mode. With an inaudible roar of massive sublight engines, the unarmed battleship crawled away from the orbital shipyards. Akbar felt as if he were part of the massive derelict ship as he controlled it from the core of Foamwander City. He paid no attention to the loud status reports and alarms in Central Command. His entire body was an extension of the Startide, and he stared through sensor eyes. Calamari's moon grew larger as he approached it, then began to streak by close to the airless cratered surface and out of sensor range to the dark side of the moon. As he brought the Startide around the curve of the moon, Akbar saw the arrowhead shape of the third Star Destroyer just powering up its weapons batteries.
There she is!
The third Star Destroyer suddenly detected the Mon Calamari battlecruiser and began unleashing a flurry of turbolaser bolts, but Akbar didn't care. Akbar drove on at full speed on his suicide run, heading directly down the Star Destroyer's throat. The Imperial ship continued to fire. Akbar released the last safety mechanisms that held the unshielded hyperdrive reactor in check. The superheated energy furnace would reach its flashpoint within seconds. He disconnected himself from the command console and let the laws of physics take their course. Admiral Dalla shouted into the comm system to the commander of the Manticore.
Captain Brusk, tell me what's going on.
Everything had been going according to plan. The Manticore had just begun its triumphant run to destroy the Calamarian shipyards when all havoc broke loose.
It's another ship, Admiral!
Admiral Dalla watched the command screen in front of her as the Calamarian battleship struck the underbelly of the Manticore. Just before the impact, though, the Startide went nova, erupting into blinding waves of energy that tore the Manticore apart. Dalla turned away, gritting her teeth, and refusing to let acid tears of failure well up in her green eyes. Kip Duran felt exhilarated, yet foolish at the same time. The other Jedi students had stopped their own exercises and dropped back to watch him at work. Surrounded by the dense foliage of the jungle, with humid air wrapped like sweat around him, Kip balanced his body, his feet extended straight up into the air, his back rigid. He held himself upright with one hand resting flat on the rough ground. The heel of his palm sank into the soft dirt, blades of sharp grass stuck between his fingers. With his free hand, Kip supported a moss-covered boulder he had uprooted from the ground. He held the rock in the air with only a small effort, using the force to do most of the work. Kip knew how to feel the force, how to use it. It came naturally to him. In little more than a week of intensive work, he had surpassed the achievements of the other Jedi students. Kip shut himself off from socialization among the trainees. He spoke to few of the others, focusing every moment upon honing his Jedi ability, increasing his concentration, developing a rapport with the Force. He hounded Master Skywalker to give him new tasks, to set him greater challenges, so he could continue to learn and grow stronger in the Force. Then Kip felt the mossy boulder levitate off his hand. Annoyed at the interruption, he opened his eyes to see Master Skywalker grinning proudly at him.
"Very good, Kip. In fact, it's incredible. I'm not sure even Obi-Wan or Yoda would know what to do with you."
Kip flipped himself upright so that he landed on his feet. Staring into Master Skywalker's eyes, he felt his heart pounding with exhilaration. "What else can you teach me today, Master?" Master Skywalker shook his head.
"Nothing more for today, Kip."
Kip tried not to let his disappointment show. "But there is so much more to learn."
Yes, and patience is one of those things to learn. The ability to do a thing is not all there is. You must know the thing. You must understand how it fits with everything else you know. You must possess it for it to be truly yours. Kip nodded solemnly, as Jedi students were expected to do, but he promised himself that he would do everything necessary to make all of these new abilities his. Even in the deepest hours of the night, Kip did not sleep. He had eaten a bland but filling meal by himself, then retired to his cool quarters to meditate and practice. As he concentrated with only a small glow lamp in the corner, he sent his mind out to feel between the cracks of all the stone blocks in the great temple. He followed the life cycles of the strands of moss. He tracked tiny arachnids skittering through the corridors and vanishing into dark spaces, where his delicate touch could follow them through the blackness into their hidden homes. As he dabbled with his fledgling abilities, he felt a great cold rip in the force, like a black gash opening the structure of the universe. He snapped himself back to the present. Kip whirled and saw behind him the looming shadow of a tall, cloaked figure. Even in the dim room, the dark man's silhouette seemed intensely black, a hole that swallowed up all glimmers of light.
The force is strong in you, Kip Duron.
Feeling no fear, Kip looked up at the shadowy figure. Who are you?
I could be your teacher. I could show you many things that even your master Skywalker does not comprehend. Do you dare to learn?
Kip felt reckless, but he trusted his instincts. They had served him well in the past. I'm not afraid to learn, but you have to tell me your name. I won't learn from a man who is afraid to identify himself. The shadowy form seemed to ripple as if with silent laughter.
I was the greatest Dark Lord of the Sith. I am Exarkin.
Hey, Lando!
Lando Calrissian heard the loud, determined voice from outside in the repair bay. Without looking, Lando knew Han Solo had come to shout at him about something. He bent down on the entrance ramp to stick his head out and saw Han hurrying toward him, his face red with agitation.
Lando, I need the Falcon now!
Han pushed past him and hit the controls for the entrance ramp. Lando had to jump inside as the greased cylinders hauled the slanted metal ramp back into position.
Han, this is my ship now. You can't just...
Han went directly to the cockpit and threw himself into the pilot seat.
What do you think you're doing?
The planet Calamari is being attacked by Admiral Dalla at this very moment.
Leia's trapped there. Now, are you going to help me go rescue her in the Falcon? Or do I pick you up by your scruffy neck and throw you off the ship?
Lando backed off, holding both palms up in a gesture of peace.
Whoa, Han. Leia's in trouble. Let's go.
But I'm flying. He motioned for Han to move into the co-pilot's chair.
It is my ship.
Stuck in hyperspace, Han Solo could do nothing but pace around the common area. Lando came from the cockpit.
She's on autopilot.
He looked at the dejected expression on Han's face and shook his head.
Han, why don't you rest? Let's kill some time.
Then, as if the idea had just occurred to him,
how about we play a round of Sabacc?
Lando raised his eyebrows and flashed one of his famous grins. Han sat down.
I don't suppose you'd put up my ship as a stake.
Lando scowled.
It's my ship, Han.
Han leaned forward across the holographic game table.
Not for long, buddy.
Kip Duron trudged through the dense rainforest of Yavin 4, trying to find hidden paths where the jungle would allow him to pass. He knew exactly where to go. The dark spirit of Exarkin had showed him. Kip's assigned companion, Dorsk 81, stumbled beside him. The thin, smooth-skinned alien had a much more difficult time with the steamy air and the steep climbs. Insects and small biting creatures buzzed and scuttled around them, but none bothered Kip. He consciously exuded a shadow of uneasiness around him, so that lower creatures had no incentive to come nearer. Exarkin had taught him that trick, too. Kip parted a dense clump of blue leaf branches. He felt an electric thrill down his spine as the Force told him they had arrived.
This,
Kip whispered,
this is our destination.
In front of them, the jungle gave way to a circular pond that shone like a flat quicksilver mirror, completely free of ripples. In the center of the lake stood a small island, dominated by an obsidian split pyramid of sharp angles showing the distinctive markings of Masasi architecture. Another temple, the same one Gantoris and Streen had located weeks before. Exarkun had told Kip all about it. Between the two parts of the bifurcated spire of the tall pyramid stood a colossus, a polished black statue of a dark man, the tattoo of a black sun emblazoned on his forehead.
Exarchin, the Dark Lord of the Sith. The giant orange sphere of Yavin and the system's small sun lurked on the horizon. They would both be setting soon. Kip went to the edge of the lake. The water was as transparent as diamond. Just below the surface, he saw columns of rock rising from the bottom like barely submerged stepping stones. Kip stepped out onto one. The clear water rippled around the bottom of his shoe, but he did not sink in. He took another step to the second stone. Toris Gaty 1 stared at him. Kip knew it looked as though he were walking on water.
"Are you using the Force?" Toris Gaty 1 asked.
"No, I'm using stepping stones." Once he reached the island, Kip stepped onto mounds of pitted volcanic rock splotched with orange and green lichen that looked like droplets of alien blood. He could already feel the power. Kip turned to watch his companion pick his way across the lake. Then he stepped into the enfolding darkness of the temple. But when he blinked his eyes, the light gradually grew inside the chamber, as if lightning bolts trapped within the black slabs of glass continued to send faint sparks, visible only from the corner of his eye. When Kip faced the polished dark walls, he saw nothing in them, only faint hieroglyphics in a long-forgotten language. He turned to see Toris Gaty 1 standing just within the opening, looking out at the jungle beyond the lake. The sphere of Yavin had vanished below the treetops, and the sky began to thicken with purple twilight as the distant sun also set.
"I'm very sleepy all of a sudden," Toris Gaty 1 said.
As if hypnotized, he shambled over to a corner and slithered down against the wall. He fell asleep almost before he had settled into place.
"Now you and I can continue in a more appropriate setting."
Kip turned to see the hooded silhouette of Exarchun, like a black oil stain shimmering in the air. Kip stood tall, squashing a thrill of terror.
"You have already learned more than Skywalker will ever know, my student."
Kip felt enthusiasm and pride burn through him. Exarchun gestured toward the obsidian walls and the incomprehensible hieroglyphs barely visible there, black lines against black volcanic glass.
"Look what I can show you today."
As Kip looked at them, the words filled with white fire, standing out against the bottomless, opaque background until they burned into his eyes. And suddenly Kip could understand. The words snapped into focus and filled his mind, an incredible history from 4,000 years ago, telling how Exarchun had begun to learn forbidden teachings, how he had come to the fourth moon of Yavin to find a lost Sith power object, and how he had enslaved the timid and weak Masasi people, making them build enormous temples for him as focal points for the dark forces he played with.
"The Brotherhood of the Sith could have ruled the galaxy, could have squashed the doddering Republic, and turned the other Jedi Knights into mere parlor magicians. But I was betrayed."
The shadow of Exarchun drifted about the floor of the temple, making no sound as he moved.
"When the Jedi combined their might and came here to this moon to fight me, they unleashed such power that I had to drain dry every last one of the Masasi just to trap my spirit within these temples, to survive so that one day I could come back."
Kip was enthralled by the new wonders Exarchun had shown him. But he was savvy enough to know when he was being manipulated. Exarchun thought he was playing Kip like a mesmerized convert, but Kip could play his own part to get what he so desperately wanted. He spread wide his arms in complete acceptance of his new instructor.
"Teach me more about the ancient Sith ways. Tell me how to use these new powers so I can crush the Empire once and for all."
Still reeling from the destruction of the Manticore, Admiral Dalla slumped against the bridge rail. She found herself at a loss for words as the battle on Calamari continued. Staring at the fiery battlefield of the ocean world below, she said,
"Dispatch the last Thai squadron. I want to lay this entire planet waste."
"Admiral!"
Commander Kratos ran between the sensor and tactical stations and up the two steps to the observation platform.
"Rebel battleships have just come out of hyperspace. An entire fleet. More than we can hope to fight."
Dalla whirled in disbelief.
"They responded to a distress call that quickly?"
Then she too saw the glinting figures of large battleships streaking like comets toward them in planetary orbit.
"Recall all Thai squadrons. Plot a straight line vector through hyperspace to the Cauldron Nebula. We'll go back and reassess our tactics, determine our losses, and we'll prepare our next attack."
Han
Han Solo and Lando Calrissian soared through the skies of Calamari in the Millennium Falcon, searching for columns of smoke rising from devastated floating settlements. They had found Foam Wander City, but when they landed on one of the emergency pads, they learned that Admiral Ackbar, Leia, and Ambassador Silgal had already departed on a rescue mission to the sunken city of Reef Home. Han was once again the pilot and owner of the Falcon, but he was so wrapped up in dismay at the devastation caused by Admiral Dalla's forces that he felt no particular jubilation at having won his ship back. All his exhilaration had evaporated upon seeing the destruction that had been wreaked on the ocean world. Lando sat at Chewbacca's station, staring at the navigation charts.
Well, looks like Reef Home City should be coming up somewhere below. I detect plenty of scattered metallic masses, but nothing that might be a metropolis.
No, just the remains, Han said. As they skimmed low, he looked out the Falcon's viewports at the floating wreckage scattered on the waves. Broken chunks of the floating Reef Home City, sealed and airtight with flood bulkheads, remained afloat like buoyant coffins. Calamarian and Quarren rescuers swarmed over the self-contained segments, trying to break through to free those inside. Han set the Falcon down on a smooth chunk of Reef Home's outer shell, then locked down the stabilizers and broke open the door seals. He clambered down the exit ramp with Lando close behind. The wounded had been dragged onto the floating wreckage of the Calamarian city, although waves sloshed over the metal edges, for now the surfaces of the fragments had been designated infirmary areas, relatively stable platforms on which the medics could tend the injured. Han stood with his legs spread wide for greater balance on the drifting fragment. He noticed a wave speeder skimming toward him. Leia piloted it, accompanied by Ackbar and a female Calamarian. Han waved frantically, and the wave speeder veered toward him, coming alongside, and Leia leapt off the vehicle as Ackbar lashed it to a ragged stump of torn metal. She walked confidently, then ran and flung herself into Han's arms. "Dalla did this, didn't she?" Han said. "We think so, but we have no proof yet," Leia said. The female Calamarian climbed out of the wave speeder and went to the triage area, glancing at the bleeding Calamarians as medics attempted to tend them. She walked among the injured, making quick pronouncements, as if she could somehow determine their chances for survival and whether precious resources should be spent treating them. Han watched her as she moved among them like an angel of life and death. "Who is that?" he asked. "Her name is Silgal. She's the Calamarian ambassador. I think she has Jedi powers. She doesn't know it yet. I'm going to make sure she goes to see Luke." Leia hugged her husband again. "I'm so glad you came."
"I was on my way the moment I heard."
Han cocked an eyebrow as he looked at Lando.
"By the way, we played another little game of Sabacc en route. This time, I won."
"The Falcon's yours again?" Leia said with delight, then slipped her arm through his. Still grinning, she looked at Lando. "Sorry to hear that, Lando."
He shrugged. "It was one way to get him off my back."
Ackbar climbed out of the skimmer and stood on the rocking wreckage. He seemed devastated. Han went up to him.
"Admiral, I heard what you did, how you defeated an entire Star Destroyer. Great work."
Leia moved beside him. "Admiral, your victory here must make up for the accident on Vortex. I hope you aren't considering going back into hiding."
Ackbar shook his massive head. "No, Leia. You've reminded me of one thing with your friendly insistence. I am not the type of person who can hide."
Leia placed a hand on the Admiral's thick biceps. "Thank you, Admiral. The New Republic needs you." But Ackbar shook his head.
"No, Leia, I won't be returning to Coruscant. I must help my people rebuild, to strengthen their civilization and to tighten their defenses against future Imperial strikes."
Han gripped Leia's shoulder, feeling iron cords of tension rippling beneath her smooth skin. With Ackbar's refusal to return to Coruscant and with Mon Mothma growing weaker day by day, Leia would have to face all the problems of the New Republic alone. As half-night fell across the jungles of Yavin 4, Luke Skywalker sat back and allowed himself to relax in one of the meeting halls. Bright glow lamps hung in old torch sconces. One of the trainees, Tian, sat in the corner preparing to play a stringed musical instrument, two hollow resonating boxes separated by a shaft strung with tonal cords.
"This is the ballad of Nomi Sunrider," she said, "one of the historical Jedi Knights."
Luke closed his eyes and heard her tale about young Nomi Sunrider, who, after her husband's murder, attended the Jedi training that had been meant for him. Nomi had become a pivotal character in the devastating Sith War that pitted Jedi against Jedi in the ancient days of the Old Republic. From the far side of the room, Luke heard a restless stirring and turned to see Kip Duron, his face stormy.
"I wish you wouldn't perpetuate that ridiculous story," Kip said. Nomi Sunrider was a victim. She fought in the Sith Wars without ever understanding what the battles were about. She listened blindly to her Jedi masters, who were afraid because Exar Kun had discovered a way for the Jedi to increase their power.
Tian, looking stricken, set her musical instrument on the flagstones and gripped her knees through the fabric of her robe.
Where did you learn all this history, Kip?
Luke stood up and put his hands on his hips, trying to stare Kip down. The young man had become more and more volatile as he acquired Jedi knowledge. Kip narrowed his eyes. He drew several deep breaths, and Luke could sense the turmoil inside him, as if his mind were working rapidly to come up with an answer.
I can use the holocron, too. As Master Skywalker keeps telling us, we are all obligated to learn everything we can.
Luke didn't quite believe the young man's words, but before he could ask another question, R2 trundled in. Luke deciphered some of the electronic language. No idea who it is?
We have a visitor, Luke announced. A ship is landing on the grid right now.
He turned to place a firm hand on Kip's shoulder, but the young man shrugged it away.
We'll discuss this later, Kip.
Relieved to have a distraction that would shatter the tension, Luke led the way. The other Jedi students followed him down the stone steps and through the hangar bay to the cleared landing grid. The cockpit doors swung up like the wings of a great insect, and the pilot emerged. A young woman stepped down, pulled off an opaque helmet, and shook her dark reddish-brown hair. Her angular face had once been pinched with determination, but now seemed softened, her eyes wider, her full lips not entirely unaccustomed to a smile.
Mara Jade, Luke said.
Over a generous meal of spiced runyip stew and bowls of chopped greens, Mara Jade said,
The New Republic is counting on your Jedi Knights, Luke, and things are getting much worse out there.
Then she told Luke and his students that Dala had attacked Dantooine.
Dantooine?
Luke said. Mara looked at him.
Yes, isn't one of your students from that group of people?
Luke's mind spun, thinking of all the refugees he had helped relocate to a supposedly safe place from the treacherous world of Il-Shah.
Not anymore. Gantoris died. He was unprepared for the powers he tried to use.
Kip Duron stood up at the far end of the long table.
I should have sacrificed myself, Kip said. I could have killed Dala with my bare hands when I was on the Gorgon.
Calm, Luke said. He gestured for Kip to sit back down, but Kip placed his hands flat on the veined stone table, leaning over to glare at Luke.
The Imperial threat is not going to go away. If we pool our Jedi powers, we can resurrect the Sun Crusher, tear it out from the core of Yavin. If we don't use our power, then we may as well not have it. We're betraying the Force with our cowardice.
He gritted his teeth, and his words came out much more quietly.
I'm not certain what else I can learn here, Master Skywalker.
With that, he vanished into the corridor. Kip felt his skin tingling with barely contained power, as if his blood had begun to fizz inside of him. He moved down the temple corridors like a projectile, and when he reached the heavy door to his quarters, he used the Force to fling it open and slam it against the far wall. How could he ever have admired Master Skywalker?
What did Han Solo see in him as a friend? The Jedi teacher was blind to reality, ignoring problems, covering his eyes with his Jedi cloak and refusing to use his own powers for the good of the New Republic. The Empire remained a threat, as Dala's attack on Dantooine demonstrated. If Skywalker refused to use his powers to wipe out the enemy, then perhaps his convictions were not strong enough. But Kip's were. He could stay at the Jedi Academy no longer. He yanked at the collar of his robe to tear it off.
From his stash of personal belongings, Kip pulled out a satchel that contained the flowing black cape that Han had given to him as a goodbye gift. During his training at the Praxium, he had been content to wear the rough old robe Master Skywalker provided, but he wanted nothing more to do with it.
Exar Kun had shown him how to unleash great powers. Kip did not trust the Sith Lord, but he could not deny the truth of what the Shadow Man taught. Kip could see the power actually working. For now, he had to get away to sort through his conflicting thoughts.
Kip pulled out the flowing cape, holding it in front of him. Its embedded reflective thread sparkled as if with hidden power. Kip wrapped it around himself and gathered a few of his other possessions. He had to go far away. He had to think. He had to be strong. Later that evening, when R2 sounded all the alarms, Luke awoke instantly. He sprinted down the corridors to the outside landing area. Mara Jade ran beside him, already alert, as if she had a good idea of what might be happening. Luke's eyes adjusted rapidly to the star-strewn sky, which was fuzzy and pale in the south with sky shine from the gas giant Yavin. Mara and Luke stood outside the half-open hangar doors as they watched her Z-95 headhunter rise from the landing grid with all its running lights darkened. "He's stealing my ship!" Mara Jade shouted. The headhunter's sublight engines kicked in, burning white-hot behind the craft as it shot into the sky. Luke shook his head in disbelief and realized that he had unconsciously extended one hand, beckoning for Kip Duron to return. The small ship became a white streak of light that grew smaller and smaller as it reached orbit, then set out among the stars. Luke felt a devastating emptiness, knowing that he had lost another of his Jedi students forever. Every flagstone gleamed. Every imperial column had been scrubbed white. Every colorful banner representing the Empire's most loyal worlds hung absolutely straight, displayed without a wrinkle. Everything was in order at the Imperial Military Academy on Carita. Ambassador Fergan nodded, just the way he liked it. 300 crack stormtroopers stood at attention in the echoing hall, motionless in perfect ranks. Their white armor glistened like polished bone. They were identical, intensively trained, precise military machines. These stormtroopers were the best of the best in the academy. Ambassador Fergon moved to the podium to address them. He drew himself up, trying to look larger than his stocky stature allowed. Imperial troops, you've been chosen to lead the most important mission since the fall of our beloved Emperor. You have endured hardship and passed many tests during your training. I have chosen you as the elite, the best trainees remaining on Carita.
They did not stir, did not congratulate each other. They remained like ranks of statues, which itself attested to the thoroughness of their training. Since receiving the long-awaited coordinates of the secret planet Anoth, Fergan had plotted this operation with extreme caution.
We have obtained secret information regarding the location of a certain baby, a child with enormous potential for using the Force. This child is the son of Leia Organa Solo, the New Republic's Minister of State. If we were to apprehend this child, it would deal an enormous psychological blow to the rebellion. But beyond that, this boy is the grandson of Darth Vader.
There, finally, he thought he heard a rustle of superstitious fear or awe.
This child could be extremely valuable to the rebirth of the Empire. A child such as this, raised properly and trained properly, could become a worthy successor to the Emperor Palpatine.
Fergan kept talking faster now as he felt the excitement within him. He was more than just an ambassador. He planned to go along on this assault himself. He would not expose himself to any part of the attack, of course, but he would be there to snatch the young child named Anakin.
Your unit leaders will provide you with specific assignments. This expedition is currently being provisioned. We have secured transports to take you to the secret location of this world.
Fergan allowed himself a broad grin with his thick purplish lips.
It is also my pleasure to announce that this assault will mark the first combat use of our new mountain terrain armored transports, on which you have been training these past months. That is all. Hail to the Emperor!
The thunderous response of filtered stormtrooper voices came back at him, rocking the hall.
Hail to the Emperor!
Fergan slipped behind the hanging purple curtains into a walkway that led to his secure office. Inside his chambers, he closed the blast-proof door and sealed it with a cipher lock. He brushed aside models and plans of the deadly new MT-AT attack vehicles. He felt immensely pleased with himself, and eager for the assault to start. Sitting on Carita during the years of turmoil, Fergan had been upset with all the rivalry among Imperial commanders since the Emperor's death. Grand Admiral Thrawn had seemed their greatest hope, but he had been defeated. And a year later, even the resurrected Emperor had been defeated. The vacuum of leadership left the Imperial forces with no leadership, no goal, battling only for their own advancement and power. Even the surprise new threat by renegade Admiral Dalla disturbed Fergan. At least Dalla was putting her Star Destroyers to an appropriate use, attacking rebel worlds and creating as much havoc as possible. But Dalla had no overriding plan, no strategy that would bring her ultimate success. She was simply a juggernaut, striking target after target for the satisfaction of causing pain. Fergan had discovered, to his surprise, that Dalla herself had been trained on Carita. Digging through old records, he had uncovered many disciplinary actions taken against her, reprimands in her file. Even then, she had been a maverick, performing admirably, but refusing to learn her place, insisting that she deserved promotions instead of others. Fergan had no record of her advancement to admiral, but Moff Tarkin had transferred her to his personal staff after one of his brief inspection tours. Fergan had no other information about Dalla since that time. It angered him that this admiral continued her attacks on the rebellion without even attempting to get in touch with Garita.
Fergan had tried to contact some of the other battling Imperial commanders to get capital ships for his assault on Anoth. The Emperor and Grand Admiral Thrawn and other depredations had already taken most of the ships available to Garita. On the military training planet, Fergan had access to some of the most sophisticated weaponry and soldiers in the entire galaxy. But because of the perpetual squabbles between the Imperial Army and the spacefaring Imperial Navy, he had no place to go with his troops. This left Fergan in a position of being on the most heavily armed but useless planet still loyal to the Empire. Fergan kept doing his best to strike vital blows against the New Republic one way or another. And as soon as Fergan had the grandson of Darth Vader in his possession, all those still loyal to the Empire would have to listen to him.
When Wedge Antilles wasn't looking, Kwee-Zook stole a glance at the coordinates displayed on his navigation panel. Sitting in the co-pilot seat of the disguised personal space yacht, Kwee used her nimble fingers to tap the coordinates into the navicomputer, requesting a full display. Wedge looked away from the starfield and caught what she was doing.
"Hey,"
he said, then grinned sheepishly as he lowered his gaze.
"This was supposed to be a surprise."
"I just wanted to know the name of the planet."
Kwee frowned as the display came up.
"Ithor? Never heard of it."
Wedge chuckled and reached over to squeeze her slender shoulder. She felt the warmth of his touch linger for several moments after he removed his hand.
"It's beautiful," he said. "A pristine natural world covered with forests and jungles, rivers and waterfalls. We'll be incognito, and you won't have to worry about anyone knowing who you are."
"Are you sure we'll be safe?"
Her greatest nightmare was that some Imperial spy might recapture her and haul her back to the Black Hole Research Lab, where they would tear the weapons knowledge out of her head, no matter how much she refused. "Yes, Ithor is an isolated paradise. It's a world where many young couples..." He paused, then swallowed as if embarrassed by the word he had just spoken. "Tourists go for vacations. Many people come and go, and these Ithorians welcome everyone."
"I really look forward to it."
Kwee smiled warmly at him. Wedge blushed, then seemed to concentrate furiously on the relatively simple task of entering a low orbit. Kip Duron brought the stolen Z-95 Headhunter into orbit around the small forest moon of Endor, where the second Death Star had been destroyed. Ignoring the ship's sensors, he reached out with his sensibility, seeking across the entire landscape for shadows or ripples in the forest. He had to find the last resting place of the only other Dark Lord of the Sith he knew of, Darth Vader. Kip felt driven to find answers to the clamoring questions in his mind. Master Skywalker said that Darth Vader, his own father, had returned to the light side in the end. From this, Kip concluded that the powers of the Sith were not permanently connected with evil. That gave him a thread of hope. He recognized full well that the dark spirit of Exar Kun had lied to him, or at least misled him. The risk was terrible, but the reward would benefit the entire galaxy. Kip instinctively brought the headhunter lower as he scanned the forests. After the rebel celebration of their victory over the Emperor, Luke Skywalker had built a pyre for his father near the towering trees not far from the Ewok villages. Skywalker had watched the roaring flames consume the remnants of Darth Vader's mechanical attire. But perhaps something had survived. As he flew onward, Kip's mind ranged far and wide across the Endor wilderness. Then he felt a ripple, an echo of something that definitely did not belong. Everything else seemed to have its place, but this did not conform, a stain that seemed to absorb all other senses, casting waves of leftover darkness that caused the creatures on Endor to avoid the place. Kip changed course and arrowed to the coordinates. He landed the headhunter in the underbrush. Afraid and yet eager, Kip swung out of the cockpit, landing with a crunch in the twigs and dead leaves. The breeze died, as if the evening forest were holding its breath around him. Kip took four steps and stopped before the scorched site of Vader's funeral pyre. The ground surrounding the old burned area remained dead and brown. Though the thick forests of Endor were tenacious and fast-growing, no plants dared approach the scar, even after 7 years. Kip knelt in the dirt. He reached out tentatively, afraid, and let his fingertips brush the age-crumbled ashes. He used the force to scatter bits of ash, blowing clear the tiny, buckled residue that had survived the fire, an unrecognizable lump of black plasteel that might have been Vader's helmet.
Growing more desperate, Kip increased his power, scouring away debris and leaving only a sad jumble of wires, melted plasteel, and shreds of tough cloth. He reached out to stroke the remnants. Electricity coursed through his hands. He knew he shouldn't be touching these relics, yet he could not turn away now. "Darth Vader, where did you go wrong?" he asked. Vader had been a monster with the blood of billions on his hands. According to Exar Kun, Anakin Skywalker had been overwhelmed by the power he had touched. Kip recognized that he had begun to walk down a similar path. But he was not so naive. Unlike Anakin Skywalker, he understood the dangers. He could guard himself. He vowed not to let Exar Kun twist him into another Vader. Kip felt confident in his determination, in his own strength of character. He could use the power of the dark side for the benefit of the New Republic. Master Skywalker was wrong. The New Republic stood on moral high ground and was justified in using any weapon, any force, to eradicate the last stains of the evil empire. Exar Kun was long dead, and Darth Vader lay in ashes on Endor. "Now I am the Lord of the Sith," Kip said. With that admission, he felt a cold strength creep up his backbone, as if his spine had turned into a column of ice. Now he and he alone had the opportunity to solve all of the New Republic's problems by himself. Reflections of the Cauldron Nebula made slow dancing patterns on the polished surface of the Gorgon's war room table. Admiral Dalla sat alone at the far end, separated from Commander Kratos, Imperial Army General Odosk, and Captain Molinar of the Basilisk. "Gentlemen," she said, "I have reassessed our mission. Our original command from Grand Moff Tarkin was to protect the Maw installation at all costs. That was why we were given 4 Star Destroyers. But we allowed the Sun Crusher, the most powerful weapon ever designed, to be stolen from our grasp, and we lost 1/4 of our fleet in a failed attempt to recapture it. Upon learning of the changed situation with the rebellion, I decided that it was more important to fight the enemies of the Empire. We left the Maw installation undefended as we harried rebel worlds. Now, after the disaster at Calamari, we have failed in that, too." Commander Kratos began to rise as if he felt compelled to defend her actions. Her hand swung up to silence him with the finality of a vibro-ax. She continued, "And so I intend to use my last resources in one final assault. If successful, it will fulfill both our missions. I mean to stab at the heart of the rebellion, Coruscant itself." A high-resolution mapping of the last known surface topography of the Emperor's planet focused on a world-sized metropolis with frozen polar caps and sparkling chains of city lights on the night side of the planet. Dalla saw space docks, curved solar mirrors that warmed the upper and lower latitudes of the planet, communications satellites, large freighters, streams of orbital traffic. Dalla gestured, and 2 fully rendered images of her star destroyers appeared traveling side by side at high speed toward Coruscant. "I intend to take all ships and all personnel onto the Gorgon, leaving only a skeleton crew on board the Basilisk. Our star destroyers will come out of hyperspace just beyond the moons of Coruscant. We will drive in at full sublight speed without hesitation straight toward our target. We will give no warning, and we will fire every turbolaser battery we have, clearing a corridor to head directly for Imperial City. Any ship that stands in our way will become a cloud of ionized metal." As she spoke, the computer animation demonstrated her tactics. The 2 star destroyers arrowed toward the capital city of the New Republic. "The Calamarian commander who defeated the Manticore gave me an idea with his suicide run. Then we shall turn the tables on them." Dalla watched the stony face of General Odosk, the appalled look of disbelief on Captain Molinar, and the stern support of Commander Kratos. "This hit and run will cause enough damage for our names to live forever in the annals of Imperial history. We shall deal a death blow to the rebel government. As we approach in-system, the Basilisk's small volunteer crew will begin a self-destruct countdown. The Gorgon will run interference until we reach our target, at which time we will turn aside. At full speed, the Basilisk will plunge into the atmosphere of Coruscant. It will be unstoppable."
But my ship," Captain Molinar said.
"It will be a glorious sacrifice," Commander Kratos said. He leaned across the polished table.
"I agree."
Dalla rose to her feet. The muscles in her thighs and back felt like tightly bundled wires. She knew the only way to release the crushing tension would be to strike a devastating blow against the rebellion.
"Begin the transfer of personnel and equipment," she said. "We must strike Coruscant at once."
The students at Luke's training center continued their lessons of self-discovery, working eagerly or meditatively, honing their skills. The newest apprentice, Silgal, the Calamarian ambassador whom Leia had recommended to Luke, answered Mara Jade's questions about the attack on Calamari. She described the Star Destroyers and the number of TIE squadrons they had carried. The remaining students sat in other common rooms or studied in their private chambers or walked out in the jungles. Satisfied by their activities, Luke slipped back into the deserted corridors and headed toward his own rooms. Luke shook his head. No, R2, I don't want to be disturbed for a while. He stepped inside his sparsely furnished chamber. On a ledge of black stone laced with blood-colored impurities sat the translucent cube of the Jedi holocron. Luke sealed his door, the first time he had ever locked it since returning to the abandoned temple. He held the holocron in his palm and activated it, digging deep to seek his information. I wish to see Master Vodosiosk Bas. The ghostly image of the nozzle-faced, stunted Jedi Master rose out of the cube, leaning on a long, gnarled stick. Luke squatted in front of the interactive holographic image. I need information from you, Master Vodo. How did Exar Kun fall at the end of the war? What happened to him? The image flickered as if something had sparked inside the holocron. Then Master Vodo reappeared.
Exar Kun was my greatest student, yet he was corrupted. Exar Kun destroyed me. He slew his own master.
Luke was suddenly jarred out of the story, remembering that the gatekeeper images in the holocron were interactive simulacra with personalities imprinted upon them, not the real spirits of long-dead Jedi masters. He asked, Then what happened to Kun at the end of the Sith War?
All the Jedi banded together and came to the jungle moon in a united front against the Sith stronghold Exar Kun had built. The allied Jedi combined their power into a massive annihilating strike.
Master Vodo's image flickered, dissolved into static, then reassembled itself.
Which obliterated the surviving Masasi natives and...
The image broke up, flickered, reformed, and then broke up again, as if something were jamming it.
But Exar Kun, what happened to Exar Kun?
Luke couldn't understand what was happening to the holocron. He shook it, tapped it a few times. Inside the static-filled cube, a dark knot appeared, like a storm gathering within its translucent walls. Suddenly, Master Vodo's image shattered into 1,000 glittering fragments of colored light, as if a greater force had torn it apart from within. The darkness inside the holocron grew deeper and larger, swelling like a slow-motion explosion. Arcs of red fire struck out in all directions from the black fist. With a high-pitched shrieking noise of discharged energy, the faces of the cube split. The holocron steamed as it collapsed with a shower of sparks, a stream of black curling smoke, and a stench of melted electronics and organic components. At the end of an exhausting day of sightseeing on Ithor, Queezooks and Wedge Antilles stood outside her vine-covered stateroom door on the Tafanda Bay, one of the enclosed eco-cities in which the Ithorians lived. Wedge looked into her indigo eyes and shuffled his feet.
Thank you, Quee said. This has been the most wonderful day of my life.
Wedge opened his mouth and closed it three times as if searching for something to say. Finally, he bent forward, touched her silky mother-of-pearl hair, then kissed her. He let his warm lips linger on hers for a long moment. She pushed closer to him and felt delight surge through her.
And now you have given me one more interesting thing, she said.
She opened her stateroom and slipped inside, feeling as if she had repulsor lifts in her feet. She leaned against the door and shut her eyes, heaving a contented sigh, and opened her eyes to see a dark man rising from his crouch in the shadowy corners of the room. The looming silhouette approached her, and she tried to shout for help, but found her voice locked in her throat. A hand reached out for her, and Kui couldn't move, couldn't duck away as the fingers wrapped around the top of her head. She blinked her wide eyes and looked up to see the face of Kip Duran, eyes blazing, his expression soulless. I have found you, Dr. Zooks. You hold too much dangerous knowledge. I must make certain no one can ever again create the weapons you've been responsible for. His fingers clamped down harder on her forehead, on her face. Her skull seemed ready to shatter. Waves of pain plunged through her brain like the claws of a nightmare monster. Kui finally managed to scream, but it was a weak, watery cry that faded as she fell down a long, dark tunnel into forgetfulness.
She slumped against the vine-covered wall of her quarters. The next morning, Wedge whistled to himself as he dressed. He ordered an exotic breakfast for two. He sauntered across the corridor, signaled at Quee's stateroom door, and waited. No answer. He signaled again and again until, alarmed, he tried to open the door. Finding the room unlocked, he was even more alarmed. He pushed the door open and rushed inside. He heard Quee before he saw her. She sat crouched in a corner, sobbing. She clutched her pearlescent hair with both hands, squeezing her temples. He ran to her. "Quee! What happened? Quee, tell me." He stared into her wide, blank eyes. She didn't appear to recognize him, and Wedge's stomach sank with horror. She shook her head slowly, then closed her eyes. Tears ran down her cheeks as she bit her lip in furious concentration. She blinked up at him again.
"Wedge? Wedge? Is your name Wedge?"
He nodded numbly, and she threw herself into his arms.
"What happened? Quee, tell me."
"I don't know."
She shook her head.
"I barely know you. I can't remember. My mind feels so empty, filled with blank spots."
Wedge held her tight as she said,
"I've lost everything. Most of my memory, my life, is gone."
Kip Duran returned to the fourth moon of Yavin in the heartbeat stillness of the jungle night. Without running lights or landing beacon, he brought the Z-95 headhunter to a gentle rest on the landing pad in front of the great temple. Leaving the headhunter behind him, he approached the monolithic ziggurat and began climbing slowly. He reached the summit of the great temple just as the huge orange ball of Yavin heaved itself over the horizon. Misty and pale, the gas giant swirled with tremendous storm systems large enough to swallow smaller worlds. The temple's diamond-shaped flagstones covered the small observation platform above the grand audience chamber. Vines and stunted masasi trees poked up from the corners of the old stones. Kip looked skyward. The small plants and animals filling the jungles of Yavin 4 were insignificant to him. They mattered nothing in the grand scheme of what he was about to undertake. The importance of his vision far exceeded the petty needs of any single planet.
"Exarkun, help me," Kip said, closing his eyes.
He reached out with his mind, following the paths of the Force that led to every object in the universe, drawing power from the cosmic focal point of the Masasi Temple. He searched, sending his thoughts like a probe deep into the storm systems of the gas giant. Behind him, Kip felt the black ice power of Exarchine arise, tapping into him and reinforcing his abilities. His own feeble exploratory touch suddenly plunged forward like a blaster bolt. Kip felt larger, a part of the jungle moon, then a part of the entire planetary system, until he burrowed into the heart of the gas giant itself. Pale orange clouds whipped past him. He sensed pressure increasing as he plummeted down, down to the incredibly dense layers near the core. He sought the tiny speck of machinery, the small, indestructible ship. When he reached the bottommost levels of the atmosphere, Kip finally found the Sun Crusher. It stood out like a beacon, a bullseye in the funneling field lines of the Force. "Size matters not," Master Skywalker had told him. Kip engulfed the Sun Crusher with his mind, touching it with his limitless, invisible hands. With the assistance of Exarchine, he used his innate skill to power up the controls again. To move control levers, push buttons to alter the course stored in the Sun Crusher's memory, bringing it out of its entombment. Kip continued to watch the weapon's progress, focusing on the sphere of the enormous planet as it crested the misty treetops. The Sun Crusher appeared as a silvery dot, seeming no larger than an atom as it emerged from the highest cloud layers and streaked across space toward the emerald green moon where Kip waited. He stared upward and waited, opening his arms to receive the indestructible weapon. The Sun Crusher approached like a long, sharp thorn of crystalline alloy, cruising upright on its long axis. Kip controlled it, slowed its descent, until the superweapon hovered to a stop suspended in front of him. As the sky brightened with planet rise, the alloy hull of the Sun Crusher seemed as pristine as a fire facet gem, scoured clean of all oxidation and debris by the intense temperatures and pressures at the core of Yavin. The Sun Crusher looked clean,
and deadly, and ready for him.
Thank you, Exarchine,
Kip whispered. Luke Skywalker awoke from another series of nightmares. He sat bolt upright on his pallet. He had felt a great disturbance in the Force. Something was not right. He got up, moving cautiously, as he sent out his thoughts to check on his students. They slept soundly, almost too soundly, as if a net of sleep had been cast over them. When he reached out farther, he was stunned to feel a cold black whirlpool of twisted force around the peak of the temple. Luke sprinted to the door of his chambers, hesitated, then stepped back to retrieve his lightsaber. He marched down the corridor, smoothing his fear as he rode the turbolift to the upper levels of the ancient pyramid.
Calm, Yoda had said. You must remain calm.
But the sight that greeted him under the dawn sky nearly overwhelmed him. The Sun Crusher hung suspended over the temple, still steaming in the morning air, resurrected from its tomb at the core of the gas giant. Kip Duran spun around to stare at Luke. Luke reeled backward. How dare you bring that weapon back? It goes against all the Jedi knowledge I have taught you. Kip laughed at him. You haven't taught me very much, Master Skywalker. I've learned a great deal beyond your feeble teachings. You pretend to be a great instructor, but you're afraid to learn for yourself. Kip looked back at the Sun Crusher. I will do what must be done to eradicate the Empire. While I make the galaxy safe for everyone, you can stay here and practice your simple Jedi tricks, but they're no more than children's games. Kip, Luke took a step toward him. You've been lured by the dark side, but you must return. You were deceived and misled. Come back before its grip becomes too strong. I went over to the dark side once, and I came back. It can be done if you're strong enough and brave enough. Are you? Skywalker, it's embarrassing for me to listen to you talk. You are afraid to risk anything yourself, yet you want to call yourself a Jedi Master. Doesn't work that way. You've stunted the training of your other Jedi candidates because of your own narrow-mindedness. Perhaps I should just defeat you here and now, and then I can take over their training.
With trembling hands and a deep-seated dread in his heart, Luke reached to his side and wrapped his hand around the slick handle of his lightsaber. He pulled it free. The brilliant green blade extended, humming and ready for battle. A Jedi could not attack an unarmed opponent, could not resort to violence before all other avenues had been exhausted. But Luke knew the deadly potential of his most talented student. If Kip had fallen to the dark side, he could become another Darth Vader. Perhaps even worse. Luke raised his lightsaber, but he was unsure what to do. He couldn't just cut down his student, but if he didn't... Don't make me fight you, he said. Kip made a dismissive gesture, and a sudden wave of dark ripples splashed across the air like the shock front from a concussion grenade. Luke stumbled backward. The lightsaber turned cold in his hand. Frost crystals grew in feathery patterns around the handle. At the core of the brilliant green blade, a shadow appeared, a black disease rotting away the purity of the beam. With a fizzle of sparks, Luke's lightsaber died. Trying to control his growing fear, Luke felt a sudden brush of cold behind him. He turned to see a black hooded silhouette. The image that had impersonated Anakin Skywalker in Luke's nightmare. The dark man who had lured Gantoris into a devastating loss of control. Kip's voice came as if from a great distance.
At last, Master Skywalker, you can meet my mentor, Exarchin.
Luke dropped his useless lightsaber and crouched. His every muscle coiled and tensed. He rallied all the powers of the Force around him, seeking any defensive tactic. With the Sun Crusher looming behind him, Kip stretched out both hands and blasted Luke with lightning bolts like black cracks in the Force. Dark tendrils rose up from gaps in the temple flagstones, fanged illusory vipers that struck at him from all sides. Luke cried out and tried to strike back, but the shadow of Exarchin joined the attack, adding more deadly force. The ancient Dark Lord of the Sith lashed out with waves of blackness, driving long icicles of frozen poison into Luke's body. Luke called upon the powers that Yoda and Obi-Wan had taught him, but everything he did, every technique, failed utterly. The black serpent-like tentacles of evil force struck at him again and again, filling his body with a pain like lava coursing through his veins. As he screamed, his voice was swallowed by a hurricane from the dark side. Near the center of the Cauldron Nebula, the two surviving Star Destroyers hung poised and ready to launch their attack on Coruscant. Admiral Dalla stood tall on her bridge platform, filled with an electrifying new self-confidence and determination.
Commander Kratos, report, Dalla said. Kratos snapped to attention, barking out his report.
All equipment and weaponry has been transferred from the Basilisk to the Gorgon. Only a skeleton crew of volunteers, all stormtroopers, remains on the Basilisk. Captain Mulliner reports he is ready for his final mission.
Dalla's clipped voice rang throughout the Gorgon. All hands, battle stations, prepare to begin our run. We will destroy Coruscant and strike a death blow to the heart of the rebellion.
Gip Duron piloted the Sun Crusher to the core of the Cauldron Nebula, where Exarchun had told him Admiral Dalla's fleet lay in wait. The Sun Crusher's sensor panels became useless in the ionized discharge from the knot of blue giant stars that illuminated the Cauldron Nebula, the front view screens dimmed to filter out the blazing light. Kip stretched out with the Force, dropping his inhibitions and letting the power burst from him like compressed gas. After the effort of yanking the Sun Crusher from the core of Yavin, finding a few star destroyers seemed a simple exercise. After only a moment, he sensed the arrowhead-shaped silhouettes of two Imperial battleships. He piloted the Sun Crusher toward the bloated supergiants at the heart of the nebula. The titanic blue stars were huge and young and ripe for destruction. On a cosmic timescale, they would burn hot but briefly, ending their lives in supernova explosions that would send shockwaves through an entire region of the galaxy. With the Sun Crusher, though, Kip could ignite the supernovas now, rather than in 100,000 years. He increased the radiation shields on the Sun Crusher and approached the mammoth stars. He powered up the targeting display in front of him. A recessed section of the control panel slid aside. A screen popped up, displaying a diagram of closely orbiting spheres. 7 enormous stars crowded in the middle of the nebula, circling in complex orbits. Kip's face was a grim mask as he flicked a row of red activator switches. He knew exactly how the Sun Crusher worked. He had stolen those memories from Kwisooks. The torus-shaped generator at the long end of the Sun Crusher powered up, crackling with blue plasma. The resonance torpedoes that triggered stellar explosions could initiate a collapse and rebound of the outer layers of star material, unleashing a tremendously violent explosion that would rip a star apart. Kip targeted the cluster of blue giant stars. He did not hesitate. He knew in his heart what he had to do. He pushed the activation buttons. The Sun Crusher shuddered as the superweapon launched 7 high-power resonance torpedoes. Against the muted swirls of the Cauldron Nebula, he saw sizzling ovoid shapes of electric green, white, and yellow fire. The energy torpedoes streaked out, plunging into the boiling surfaces of the giant stars. But it would take time for the torpedoes to tunnel to the stellar cores and set up the chain reaction. He pulled away at a leisurely pace. The waiting seemed to go on forever. He sent out his thoughts again, wishing he could taunt Dalla. The Sun Crusher was so small that few sensor systems could detect it, especially within the electromagnetic chaos of the Cauldron Nebula. Then, unexpectedly, her star destroyers began to move. The Basilisk and the Gorgon powered up their sublight engines and started a slow drift as if they were ready to launch another attack. Kip felt a flame of anger sear through him. No, she can't leave now! He could not go back and stop the explosion of the core stars. Dalla had to stay where she would be trapped. Kip slapped at the Sun Crusher's weapon control systems, powering up the defensive laser cannons. Then he shot forward at full thrust. Admiral Dalla raised her right hand, looking at the navigator. Prepare to engage hyperdrive, she said.
Admiral!
The lieutenant at the sensor station cried.
I've detected an intruder!
A tiny ship streaked across the bow of the Gorgon, blasting at them with puny laser strikes.
What? Dalla turned. View screen, she called. Enhance!
A shimmering image of Captain Mulliner from the Basilisk appeared at the comm station beside her.
Admiral, we've just detected the Sun Crusher. Should we engage?
The Sun Crusher? Dalla took a second to process the information. She could not answer before the small ship flitted in front of the Gorgon's bridge tower again, blasting at the turbolaser batteries. She instantly recognized the thorn-shaped ship, but the Sun Crusher's lasers had too little power to cause damage to a star destroyer. Dalla felt a new excitement.
I want the Sun Crusher recaptured. This changes everything in our strategy against the New Republic.
Why does he attack us at all? Dalla said, tapping black-gloved fingers on the bridge railing.
Something's wrong here.
He provoked us, but he has no way of causing us damage. Why did he call attention to himself? And how did he find us here? Commander Kratos answered her, although she had been muttering to herself.
I can't speculate on that, Admiral. Bring the Star Destroyers about. Lock a tractor beam on the Sun Crusher next time it passes.
Admiral, The Sun Crusher is signaling us, the comm officer called. Voice-only transmission.
Dalek World.
Put the pilot on.
Admiral Dalla, I'm Kip Duran. Remember me? I hope so. You put me under a death sentence. That made quite an impression on me. I hope it made some sort of impression on you.
Kip Duran, if you surrender immediately and deliver the Sun Crusher intact, we will take you to the planet of your choice. You can be free. Don't be foolish.
Not a chance, Admiral.
Kip cut off the transmission and streaked by again, firing darts of laser energy that bounced harmlessly off the shielded hull of the Star Destroyer.
Tractor beam lock, the tactical officer said. Lost it.
Admiral,
the sensor chief broke in. I'm picking up unusual readings from the star cluster. The blue giants are fluctuating, all seven of them. I've never seen anything like...
Dalla froze. Her mouth dropped open in horror as she suddenly realized the terrible plan this boy had put into effect against her fleet.
Pull about! 180 degrees, maximum speed. Get out of the nebula now.
But, Admiral,
Commander Kratos said. He's used the Sun Crusher. The stars are going to explode. Inform the Basilisk.
The sublight engines powered up, blasting as they lumbered away from the center of the nebula, picking up speed. The hyperdrive engines were primed, gathering power. The Star Destroyers began to move away. Kip Duran watched the Star Destroyers wheel about and flee like wounded banthas.
You can't get away fast enough. He smiled. Not fast enough.
The Gorgon and the Basilisk began to heave themselves through the nebula at top speed. Kip punched his engines to twice the Sun Crusher's maximum rated capacity, shooting straight up and out of the plane of the nebula cloud. When the cluster of blue giants detonated, concentric shockwaves of blinding light and searing radiation blasted outward like a cosmic hurricane. Hauling on the controls, Kip continued the Sun Crusher's race upward, confident that the quantum armor would protect him from the worst. The incredible surge of energy from the supernovas darkened his viewports to near opacity. Curtains of fire overtook the Basilisk, washing over the Star Destroyer and igniting it like another tiny nova erupting in the nebula as the firestorm front swept on. The view screen blackened, but where the Gorgon had been, Kip saw another flash, and then the firestorm obliterated all detail. After his screens became completely opaque, Kip used the onboard navicomputer to set a new course. This was just the beginning. In the morning coolness of Yavin 4, Ambassador Silgal rose in her austere quarters and basked in the shadowy dampness of the stone temple. She had been at the Jedi Praxium for only a few days, but already she felt as if the whole universe had opened for her. Master Skywalker's exercises in attuning her mind to the Force had shown her how to turn her gaze in a new direction, to see things in full view that she had previously only glimpsed out of the corners of her eyes. Silgal left her quarters and moved to join the dozen other Jedi candidates in the dining hall. The rest of the Jedi trainees sat by themselves or in small groups, talking uneasily. Silgal did not see Master Skywalker among them. He was usually the first to enter the dining hall, waiting for his students to join him. The other Jedi trainees seemed disconcerted by the change of routine. Finally, Streen stood up and looked around in alarm.
It's too quiet, he said. Too quiet.
Tian rushed into the dining hall, clutching her twin-boxed musical instrument. Her pearly eyes were panic-stricken.
Come quickly. I've found Master Skywalker.
Without question, without confusion, all the Jedi trainees rose in a coordinated flowing movement. They moved together and sprinted after Tian as she ran down the winding moss-grown halls. They reached a back staircase of worn stone steps that led to the observation platform at the top of the temple. Silgal drew up short as she noticed the robed figure sprawled on the flagstones under the sky. His hands were thrown back as if to defend against something.
Master Skywalker, she called.
The other trainees rushed forward. Silgal pushed through the gathered students and knelt beside the fallen man. Luke's face seemed curdled in an outcry of pain or fear. His eyes were squeezed shut. His lips were curled back in a grimace. On the stone floor beside him lay his lightsaber, as if it had proven useless against whatever enemy he had fought. Silgal propped Luke's head up, touching his pale brown hair. Rivulets of cold sweat glistened on his face, but she felt no warmth on his skin. She probed, using her newfound abilities in the Force, desperately searching.
What happened to him?
Dorskady One said in great alarm.
Is he alive?
Streen asked. Silgal probed with her sensing abilities and shook her head.
He's breathing. I can sense very little heartbeat, just the faintest pulse. But I can't find him inside.
When I touch him with the Force, all I find is a great empty spot.
She turned to look at the others with her sad, round, Calamarian eyes.
It's as if he has left us. What can we do? Kiranati asked.
Silgal cradled Luke's motionless head in her lap and blinked her huge Calamarian eyes, unable to speak for a long moment.
We are all alone now, she finally said.
This is Anthony Heald. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Dark Apprentice by Kevin J. Anderson. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Lars Howell, abridgment by Trevi Johnson. Dark Apprentice is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 1994, all rights reserved. The book Star Wars Dark Apprentice, Volume 2 of the Jedi Academy trilogy, is available wherever Bantam books are sold. Look for the final installment in the Jedi Academy trilogy, Champions of the Force, coming soon.